Welcome to the Fantastic Four, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. This is the podcast that combines comics, cocktails, and conversation for your listening pleasure. I am your host, Brett Young. And because someone has clearly read my fan fiction about the secret origin of Batman and Sandman wearing fishnets and hanging out in the Boston bar in the 80s, who better to have on my show than fellow FW All-Star Ryan Daly? Welcome to the Fantastic Lounge, Ryan. How you doing?
I am doing very well. Thank you very much for having me on the show. It's interesting that despite having done Cheerscast for like 7 or 8 years now, It is only now this past month that I have been a guest on two shows wherein a requirement has been to drink alcoholic beverage. So,
very good.
Check out Jeff and Rick Presents Unpacking the Power Pack. I was on their most recent episode that was released at the time of this recording.
Yeah, well, I've been on the show too. I just listened to your episode yesterday, actually. So I highly recommend it. They're good guys, and Ryan did a great episode with it. So now, real quick, Ryan, before we begin, I had to ask, are you still familiar with all NATO and Warsaw Pact small arms before we begin? I just want to make sure everyone's good with that.
I never knew what that meant for the longest time. Like, I saw that on every file card and I was like, what? But again, being a kid, but it was like, yeah, I learned, oh gosh. So yeah, without giving it away yet, but yeah, the book, the content that taught me so much weird military jargon.
I know
that Charlie Mike means continue mission. Mm-hmm. What is Willie Pete stands for white phosphorus,
yes,
which is what you
yes.
throw when you need a extraction via helicopter or something.
Yep, absolutely. Yep, that's where I learned sea rations. I learned all sorts of stuff. Sea rats, I think they called it. Yeah. All sorts of stuff. So, All right. Well, let's get on with it. Let's not get too far ahead of ourselves. Let's get on with the show. So, sometime ahead of recording each podcast, I ask my guests two things: choose an alcohol, beverage, or ingredient that they enjoy, and choose a comic book character they love. Now, based on the answers, I come up with a cocktail for us to create and choose a comic book character to discuss, or a comic book to discuss. Now, Ryan, please tell our friends in the lounge your chosen ingredient and comic book character. Let's start with your character.
Well, I didn't choose a character, per se, and I didn't even choose a team. I chose an entire army, or at least a special military unit within an army, because we are talking about G.I. Joe.
Yes.
More specifically, the G.I. Joe, a real American hero imprint of that property that originated in 1982 and to some form or another has continued since then.
Now, why G.I. Joe?
It was the dominant fandom of my childhood and to an extent continued well into adulthood. It wasn't the first fandom or toy that I really grew up with. I mean, I think Star Wars was kind of in it from conception, just because, you know, my brother had the toy, my older brother had those toys, and I was allowed to play with those as I was growing older. And then Transformers appealed to me a little bit earlier, just because it was cars and robots, and you know, that thing for a kid, of course, that's what you would gravitate to. But G.I. Joe, I was born in 81, about 6 months before the toy line like premiered and everything like that, so I was right there. I you know, my older brother started collecting the G.I. Joe toys because he wanted to supplement his squad of Endor rebel troopers from Return of a Jedi, so he needed another group of guys that looked vaguely greenish like soldiers. So, and then of course that sprang into a larger thing, and I sort of inherited his collection and kind of picked it up on my own in the mid 80s, and it became my thing and stuck with it until the end, until like 1984 when it was canceled. And then after college, like when I first discovered what eBay was, I went back and bought a bunch of the old toys and kind of tried to reclaim that, and then went back and reread all the old comics that I was collecting. G.I. Joe was the first comic I ever read. So that's kind of apt to what we're going to be talking about here. And even now today, the G.I. Joe classified 6-inch action figure line that Hasbro is producing today, I'm an avid fan of that too.
So G.I. Joe is a code name for a daring American Special Missions Force whose purpose is to defend human freedom against Cobra, a ruthless terrorist organization determined to rule the world. First appearance of this iteration, G.I. Joe, a real American hero, issue 1 from March of 1982. This iteration of G.I. Joe was created by Larry Hama. Okay, so we'll get back to the Joes, but right now, let's talk about your beverage of choice. What did you choose and why did you choose it?
Well, I chose bourbon because our brother in the network, Chris Franklin, is from Kentucky and he couldn't be here, so I wanted to represent. No, it's just no, it's just it's kind of become my drink. Once I reached high school, I realized I had to stop messing around with rum and cokes anymore and had to no, it's I've never been a big beer fan. I'll drink it on occasion. There are certainly times, like usually dependent on meals, like if I'm eating pizza or Mexican food, sometimes I'll want to have a beer with it. But most of the time, like socially or like engagement or something like that, I'll go for a cocktail or a mixed drink, or sometimes I'll just have like a scotch or a whiskey or a bourbon just on ice by itself, and I'll finish the day that way.
Yeah. Do you do the big cube or
I actually
just
I
glass
do.
only?
So we got like some specialty ice cube trays. We've got one giant cube that I went with this time, but we
Wow.
also have one that produces spherical cubes designed to look like the Death Star. And
Oh, how
I almost went with
cool.
that one tonight, but I was like, you know what? I don't want to cross pollinate the
Yeah, we're
fandoms right
crossing
now.
genres here. Come on. Yeah, we don't want to destroy anything. Yeah. No, that's awesome. Yeah, I'm always on the lookout. I'm a big fan of the big cube too, and bourbon and whiskey Jones, one of those things that just goes perfect with it. Now is that how you normally, like, on in general, if you'd have a bourbon, is that how you'd have it normally, either neat or on it, or like with a big cube, or how do you?
Sometimes I'll just have it by itself with a night with ice. Sometimes I'll mix it with ginger ale or something else to kind of like cut it down and thin it. But it's usually if I'm a lot of times I'll just have it by itself.
Yeah. Do you have a bourbon choice?
Well, the one I'm going to be using tonight is Knob Creek. That's one of my
Hmm.
favorites, but
Yeah.
I'll drink Maker's Mark a lot because it's a little bit cheaper, but I like it more than stuff like, Johnny Walker or Crown Royal or not Johnny Walker, Jim Beam.
Jim Beam, yeah.
Yeah, man.
I have a soft spot for Jim Beam. For some reason, I think it's because when I was younger, it was one of those ones that we would get. He said it's a little less expensive, and it was good bourbon to mix. So I bought, even to this day, I usually have some, like a small bottle of Jim Beam somewhere. And we used to get this stuff called Early Times, which was like a knockoff. It was sort of like a
Nice.
it was I think it was more of like a Jack Daniel's knockoff, but kind of looked like it was just like almost like if you'd go to Costco, they have their own brand version. This was sort of like, the lower end version of that, but tasted pretty much the same. But yeah, I Knob Creek's great. I was nice solid bottle too. I like their sort of rectangular bottle. It's got some heft to it. I'm a big fan of Basil Hayden. If you're
I've
familiar
heard of
with
that one.
that.
I've never tried it.
Yeah, that's really good. Angel's Envy is another one. I drink a lot. Basil Hayden, it has like sort of this, like this almost looks like it's wearing like a burlap sack over it. It's just like a, like it's just like paper sort of covering it, the label and everything. It's loose. But that's one I go to a lot. Buffalo Trace is a good one. If you've ever, heard of Pappy Van Winkle and that type of stuff, and the different ages of those, well, that's good. So I'm a fan of bourbon as well, obviously. And so the drink we're going to be making, based on a bourbon, is a nice bourbon summer cocktail. Now, before we go over the recipe, I wanted to talk a little bit more about bourbon and its ties to warfare in a segment I like to call Secret Origins. See what I did there, Ryan? Because you're familiar with Secret Origins, of course. That
I
was
have,
your
yes.
that yeah that was your seminal podcast. And so if anybody in the Fantastic Lounge, if you've not listened to Ryan's Secret Origins podcast, I highly, highly, highly
How
recommend it.
dare you?
Yes. First of all, how dare you? Second of all, go. It's still available on the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Please go check it out. It was terrific. It was
Oh.
terrific. Yeah.
Secret Porigens. I do get it.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. You get it now?
Got it. Okay.
Good. Finally. Finally, someone gets it. Oh, good. Wait, it's my ninth episode. Somebody finally got it. Thank you.
Whew.
Thank you, Ryan.
Oh, I'm glad now I'm glad I did that podcast 7 years ago.
All right. So anyway, thanks to greatjonesdistilling.com, whiskey.com, and tastingtable.com for the research for this. So our bourbon at war. Bourbon dates back to the 1700s when the Dutch, Scottish, German, British, and French settlers brought their distilling crafts to our shores. Corn was a popular base product as it was plentiful, sweet, and grew faster than other grains that they were used to overseas. After George Washington, then president, instilled a distilling tax, many brewers fled to Kentucky. Unfortunately for them, they still had to pay the tax, but corn was aplenty. This made Kentucky ground zero for bourbon distilling. So, by the way, Bourbon County in Kentucky was named after the French royal family who supported us during the American Revolution. To make bourbon, you must have follow these rules. Spirit must be produced in the U.S. The grain used in the mash, what bourbon is distilled from, must be at least 51% corn. The spirit must be aged in new charred oak barrels. The spirit coming out of the still is a maximum of 80% alcohol, which is 160 proof. When placed in the barrel, the spirit must be no more than 62.5% alcohol by volume. The bottle spirit must be a minimum of 40% ABV, alcohol beverage volume, by volume, which is 80 proof. And it must not contain any flavoring or coloring. Now, how does this tie into war? Well, in the Revolutionary War, as the war with the British hindered the sugar trade, therefore rum production was down, Americans resorted to distilling from native grains like rye and corn to make spirits. When the 15th state, Kentucky, joined the Union, more Americans moved into the Ohio River Valley region where corn grows particularly well, paving the way for the bluegrass state to eventually become the epicenter of bourbon. And these days, I believe about 95% of bourbon is made in Kentucky. So the Civil War created some big changes to bourbon. In 1862, President Lincoln instilled a whiskey tax to help pay for the Union war expenses. In the South, Confederates instituted a prohibition on drinking bourbon as they needed whiskey for medicinal purposes. Bourbon became rare, and what bottles were available were sold on the black market. What may have gone for a half-gallon bottle may have gone for 20 cents prior to the war beginning. By the end of 1863, that same half-gallon bottle would go for about $17 on the black market. Back then, that's a big cost.
Yikes.
But the primary reason for the prohibition in the South was actually because they needed the copper used in the distilleries for army materials and cannons. Now, as the Union soldiers marched south, they were exposed to bourbon whiskey, a sweeter alternative to the rye whiskey they normally drank in the North. Even General Ulysses S. Grant was known to enjoy Old Crow. The Northerners found a new appreciation for corn mash whiskey, and that contributed to an increase in bourbon distilleries and production. Now, during the First World War, U.S. consumption and production of bourbon dropped significantly because most distilleries were needed for the war effort to produce gunpowder. Now, because the need for ammunition and lack of access to the usual ingredients, bourbon production was affected in quality and quantity. This in part contributed to the push for prohibition post-World War I. Now, when the U.S. joined World War II, the Government War Production Board once again converted bourbon distilleries to help our boys overseas. Now, they retrofitted these distilleries and they became production factories for penicillin and other medicines, as well as ammunition and synthetic rubber. Now, there was alcohol being produced, but it was not for drinking. They were making non-consumable, high-proof spirits, good for making things like antifreeze and antiseptic. So I wouldn't recommend drinking those. And that's it. There were no more wars after that. So we're all good. And bourbon was back on base. So there you go. So, Ryan,
I'm still on the
yes, go
aspect
ahead.
of the Revolutionary War. I'm like, I'm sure Hamilton does a song about it, right? That's got to be part of it. So,
It's got you. I would think so. I would think so. Have you seen that, by the way? Have you seen Hamilton?
I'm not on stage, but I've seen the staged film part on Disney Plus. I watched that.
Same. My wife went to go see it and stuff like that at the what was
Yeah.
then the Kennedy Center, and now it's a disaster.
Yeah,
I've just seen it on TV as well.
somehow my wife got my son interested in that too, or vice versa. I don't know what it is, but I just know that my 8-year-old has been walking around going, "I am not throwing away my shot." Like, seriously, we're doing this now? All right.
Worst things he could be saying.
Sure.
All right, so Ryan, it's happy hour. So let's make this drink. Now I call this U2 Scarface. That'll make more sense when we read our comic. But Ryan, why don't you tell our friends in the lounge what they need?
All right, the special ingredients for this one. You will need 2 ounces of bourbon, a half ounce of lemon juice, some aromatic bitters, 2 sprigs of mint, 2 lemon wheels, and ginger beer. And to garnish this drink, you can use a lemon twist and a mint sprig.
Very good. Now, what you want to do is in the shaker, add the 2 mint sprigs, which would be 5 to 10 mint leaves, the 2 lemon wheels, half ounce of lemon juice. Basically, just cut a lemon in half, squeeze that half in there. That's enough for it. And 3 dashes of bitters. Now, you could use any aromatic bitters. I happen to have a whole bunch of bitters, so I use ginger bitters for this because there's also ginger beer involved. But you can use whatever. You can try different things. So take all that in the shaker and gently muddle. Then add the bourbon and stir. Now, if you want to, you could also add ice to the shaker. Instead of stirring it, you could shake it up. You can do it either way. What that's going to do is probably when you strain it, if you shake it up, you're going to get more of the mint particles in there, which will lead to sort of a dirtier drink, so to speak. But either way, if you like the mint particles, that's fine. If you want it to look a little cleaner, I would just stir it and again, then strain it into a rocks glass or highball with ice already in it, and then top it with ginger beer, and then garnish with the lemon twist and a mint sprig. So now Ryan and I are going to try our U2 Scarface while you enjoy this promo break.
G.I. Joe will return after these messages.
Batman Nightcast is back with new episodes every month.
This time, we're covering the Dark Knight stories we overlooked in previous iterations of this show.
Anyway, I'm Chris Franklin.
And I'm Ryan Daly.
Join us as we find our joy with Batman Comics chronicling the Caped Crusader's first adventures with the Boy Wonder.
Thrill as we review the fiendish plots of a who's who of villains, like Poison Ivy, Killer Croc, Gentleman Ghost, and Clayface 3.
If this is a bit, I don't understand it.
Hey kids, comics by legendary creators Don Newton, Neil Adams, Marshall Rogers, and Bill Sienkiewicz.
Plus, the single greatest Batman story ever told.
It all comes back to Batman Nightcast.
I don't know what's happening right now.
New episodes every month.
Batman Nightcast, part of the Fire & Water Podcast Network.
Wanna make something of it?
Did you fall on your head?
Now, back to G.I. Joe.
And we're back. Ryan and I knocked back a few while we wore Destro masks and punched each other in the face. I don't recommend it. Now that we've had a chance to try our U2 Scarface, Ryan, what do you think?
Oh, this is so disgusting. No.
Let's cut
No,
the
it's
feet. Cut the feet. No, go ahead.
yeah.
Sorry.
It's good. I dare say this is very lemony. I'm not sure if there was a something in the production of my drink, but I'm getting a lot of lemon and a lot of mint and a dash of the ginger beer. I'm not tasting that much bourbon. So there may have been an error in how I made this, but
I tend not to use a lot of the ginger beer. So it's possible that, or maybe it was a touch more lemon. I definitely get the citrus. I get a little bit of the mint. But I'm getting a little bit of that bourbon finish, that bite on the back end. So
Yeah, I'm
if you're
getting that.
not
I'm
getting
feeling
enough, if you're not getting enough, cut back on the ginger beer, or maybe you can cut back on the lemon juice a little bit because that can kind of cut through sometimes. What you could always do is if it's too much lemon for you, either skip the lemon juice part and just use the lemon wheels, or just use the lemon juice and don't use the lemon wheels. Either way,
Sure.
I just usually add the wheels because they don't add too much, excuse me, lemon zest. But I like sort of that pulp a little bit to it.
Yeah,
I
no, I
just
get
think
it.
it adds a little something. So, I would definitely recommend that you can kind of, you can add or subtract a little bit from this recipe. I tried to make it a very easy drinking one. A little bubbly with the ginger beer, a little bit of that spice, the minty finish, citrusy, a little sweetness. There's a
I
lot of
will
different
say,
tastes going on here. Yeah.
despite the strong flavors of both lemon and mint, it goes down pretty smooth. So whatever they're working in concert together, it's very easy to drink.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Well, very good. Well, while we enjoy our U2 Scarface and the Fantastic Lounge, how about some fine literature? The comic we will be discussing that involves G.I. Joe is G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero, issue 16, publisher Marvel Comics, cover date October 1983, on sale date July 12th, 1983, cover price 60 cents. Story title is Night Attack, written by Larry Hama. Penciler and cover artist is Mike Vosburgh. Inker is John
Agostino.
Thank you, John Agostino. Letter, Joe Rosen. Colorist, Andy Yunkus. And editor, Denny O'Neill. And thank you, MarvelFandom.com, for that information. Now, Ryan, would you like to tell our friends in the lounge what this story is about?
I would love to. During a routine training session, the G.I. Joe team meet their newest recruits, Tripwire, the klutzy bomb specialist, and Cover Girl, the fashion model turned tank driver who happens to be David Ace Gutierrez's favorite character. Colonel Hawk believes that Cobra is planning to poison America's money at the source, the Bureau of Printing and Engraving. By the way, free tour in Washington, D.C. But General Flagg tells him the brass has assigned all of its available military assets to defend the Capitol. Meanwhile, Cobra Commander treats the upper echelons of his organization to a lavish four-course dinner. Lavish, considering they're in the trailer of an 18-wheel semi-truck bound for D.C. Everyone in Cobra's high command has his or her own secret agenda. Destro and the Baroness try to hide their affair from Cobra Commander. Major Blood tries to hide the fact that Cobra Commander enlisted him to kill Destro. And Scarface tries to hide his disdain for Dr. Venom. Cobra launches a fake assault on the Capitol using, no joke, model planes and toy parachutes. The real attack at is at the Treasury building, where Dr. Venom and Scarface enact their plot to coat money with a lethal toxin. A trio of Joes, including new recruit Tripwire, the shirtless Cajun Marine Gung-Ho, and Navy SEAL Torpedo, who, despite the complete absence of swimming water in the printing room, is dressed in his scuba gear, rebreather, and fins, because that's how cool he is. Dr. Venom plants a bomb and takes off, leaving Scarface for dead as payback for some stuff that happened 3 issues ago. Tripwire disarms the bomb, but Scarface escapes just as Cobra Commander and Destro crash into the building in a hiss tank, capture the three Joes, and reclaim Dr. Venom's toxin. Cover Girl and her Wolverine vehicle rescue the Joes, and an all-out tank battle ensues, validating the armored training session at the beginning of this issue. During the chaos, Cobra Commander orders Major Blood to fire on Destro from the turret of his tank. But Baroness is driving that hiss and deliberately crashes it to save Destro. Major Blood runs away, leaving Baroness trapped in the hiss as Cover Girl blows it up. A heartbroken Destro succumbs to despair, so Cobra Commander tells Venom to drive them out of the city while he mans the turret. Colonel Hawk catches up to them and jumps on board the hiss. While Destro cries over the Baroness, Hawk confronts Cobra Commander at last and tells the King Snake to catch his hands. Midway through the pummeling, Destro snaps out of his funk and grapples with Hawk. Cobra Commander draws his sidearm and has to decide which of the two to shoot. He fires 3 rounds into Hawk's back, and they dump the Joe leader on the road as they make their escape. Elsewhere, Scarface gets on a commuter bus and vows to get revenge on Dr. Venom.
Very nice. So what did you think of the issue overall?
So peeking behind the curtain, when I, the whole thing, you know, as he usually does, Brett's like, hey, which character do you want to talk about? Give me a list. And I sent out a couple of Marvel heroes and a couple of DC heroes. But knowing that Brett has mentioned G.I. Joe in our group chat a few times, I'm like, I think I know what he would love to talk about on this show if I can do that. So I asked for G.I. Joe and he's like, got it. And he said, okay, there's 3 issues that I'm talking about. And we hadn't talked about those before.
No.
But 2 of the 3 issues you sent me are in my like top 5 favorite issues of the series.
Oh, that's awesome.
And the other third one is well up there. But I think at any given time, I think this is my favorite issue of G.I. Joe. It's not the best. I'm not going to say it's the best. Mm-hmm. But this has so much that I like that kind of hits me in my sweet spot. It's the introduction to a few fan favorite beloved things, like a few characters like Cover Girl. It's our first time seeing her, first time seeing Tripwire, who is a character that I have always loved, even though there's not really a reason to, because his figure was pretty lame. He had a mind detector. He didn't have any gun or weapon. Like he what didn't he wasn't useful as a battlefield type of character. And he's kind of depicted as a clumsy guy, despite like being the guy who defuses bombs. So that was kind of ironic. We see the first the Wolverine. It's the first time seeing that vehicle. It's also our first time seeing the Dragonfly helicopter. Now we've seen Wild Bill piloting a helicopter in previous issues, but he's just flying like a Huey or like a generic chopper. This is the first time we actually see the Dragonfly on the page. But there's also like, I mean, there's this battle. Another crazy thing, and I kind of made fun of it, but I love Torpedo. Torpedo is on any given day my first or second favorite G.I. Joe, despite the fact that the toy, he's just in a scuba suit and it's like, okay, this is the guy you can play with in the bathtub or in the swimming pool, and you can't really do anything else with him because he doesn't stick out. And it's like, but when you find, I was like, and like when I grew up, I was like, wait, Navy SEALs are so much more than that. But Hasbro was like, okay, he's the water guy, so always put him in water. And the edict that they passed down to Marvel Comics was the characters, Mike Vosper, they have to be toy accurate or as close to toy accurate as possible. So even though it makes no damn sense for Torpedo to be in a land mission in an urban environment wearing his swimsuit with his mask on and his fins on his feet and carrying his harpoon gun, his spear gun, that makes no sense. It's like somebody just plopped him out of the end of the fourth James Bond movie, which Thunderball. And just put him in the wrong environment. So it's like, okay, this is ridiculous.
No prize to that would be he must have gone there via the Potomac River. That's the only thing I can think of. So he
Yeah.
just hopped out of the Potomac
That
and
would have been
sloshed
a
over
great
there.
scene. That would have been a great scene, yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
But he kills a Cobra in this issue. It's like the most, it's like the
With a
coolest thing he
spear gun,
does
yeah.
in all of the comics. He shoots a guy with a spear. But then there's the big thing at the end, like they shoot Hawk. Like, well, first of all, you think they set it up so that you think maybe the Baroness is dead, and then they shoot Hawk in the back, and it looks like maybe they've killed him off by the end of it. Now, neither of those characters are dead, but a few issues later from this, at the end of this kind of the Dr. Venom saga, which really kind of runs from issues 10 to issue 19, they kill off three, no, four major characters in that, but they were all four characters that didn't have action figures. They were characters created just for the comic. But in this one, I remember thinking, like, because I didn't read this at the time. I didn't read this until, actually, I didn't read this one until the early 2000s when I got the trade paperback, because this is one of the issues that I didn't have a physical copy of. But I knew kind of the events of the story. But I remember by then I was able to kind of think about the context, like, okay, Colonel Hawk is the leader of this comic. And like from the beginning, he was set up in that capacity. But Duke is right around the corner. They're going to introduce him as their kind of like the top sergeant, like the field commander in charge in a few issues. And this issue came out just 2 months before the first G.I. Joe animated series came out. And Duke is the Captain America of that cartoon. So like Duke was going to be the poster child for G.I. Joe. And I just wondered if there was ever a moment where they thought, we can kill off Hawk. We can kill off the Joe's leader in this issue because we've got his replacement waiting in the wings. And we'll just bring in Duke and he'll be the new guy. And I just wonder if that was ever a consideration. Like, if I haven't met Larry Hama, but if I do, I'm going to ask him that.
I would wonder that too. And the weird thing about Hawk was he was kind of like, if you tie it into the toys, he w didn't have like an individual figure. He came with like a big like a I don't it was
A
a
missile
like a
launcher. It's
missile
like a,
launcher or
yeah.
something like that. Yeah, just something strange. Like you had to. So he was sort of this afterthought as far as the toys go, but was front and center in the comic book. And yeah, I agree. That's interesting because he's, to be honest, I mean, when they brought out Duke basically looked like a younger version of Hawk. I mean, he basically looked like the exact same guy and everything. And it was a little more interesting visually, was more interesting, had a different costume on, you know, like a different color shirt. I mean, Hawk's basically just wearing the basic, you know, green fatigues. So yeah, I wonder about that too. That's a good question. And yeah, I don't know what their plans were, although, you know, the next issue immediately they pretty much just, you know, say like, oh, he's going to be fine. He's wearing like this SWAT vest or something like that, so he's going to be fine. But But yeah, I really enjoy, obviously I enjoyed this issue too. It's one of the ones that I pointed out, because it's a good mashup of all these different Joes in a big battle scene. It's kind of one of those cool things, like you could envision playing with your toys with this. I mean, that splash page could be a toy commercial. I mean, basically,
sure, absolutely.
You have the Mobat, the motorcycle, the helicopter, and the vamp, the Jeep, you know, all like coming, you know, and coming at you. And, this was kind of one of the first times you get an actual, I mean, you get a fist fight between Hawk and Cobra Commander, which I don't know if I'm trying to remember, because I did a quick, you know, when we were talking about this, I went back to the beginning and did a quick read through up to 16 just to familiarize myself, because it had been years since I've read some of these.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if they had ever actually been in the same room together.
Nope.
So this is kind of the first time they're engaging.
I think the only time the Joes were like in the same room as Cobra Commander, I think, was in the first issue. And maybe it was just Scarlet and Snake Eyes?
It was just Scarlet and Snake Eyes, yeah. And then a couple more, and then he like gets away in some confusion or something. Yes, you're right. It was the first issue, yeah. So that was sort of like, oh, wow, you know, they're finally, you know, mano a mano. And Destro was pretty much a brand new character at that point. He'd been in a couple issues. But the intrigue of the, you know, the sort of the palace intrigue of the dinner, which that truck must have unbelievable shocks, by the way, that they're able to have like a candlelit dinner, you know, in the back of a semi, you know, that's right. And they're all like, you know, you have the individual thought bubbles of them all, like they all hate each other and who one wants to stab that one in the back. And, you know, Commander's line about, you know, Major Blood, you know, being a despicable bootlicker, everything Destro isn't, which is why I want him to kill Destro, you know. You know, because, you know, only bootlickers in my employ, you know.
Exactly.
Kind of like how Shag likes it. Yeah.
Exactly. If you're insecure about your leadership, surround yourself with sycophants that won't challange you. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank goodness that doesn't happen around
we,
here.
We never see that in our contemporary life. Yeah.
Fortunately not. Yeah. But I love what you said about Torpedo, you know, the whole wetsuit and flippers thing. It's just so great, so silly, you know, and almost the way he's drawn, you can be like, look at him, he's got to sort of flop around, you know. Just, you know, at least Vosburgh put him up on the railing.
On the catwalk,
you know, as opposed to down below. So at least he could kind of like roll and hide and everything like that. But I was a big fan of Dr. Venom. He was sort of the early, you know, this is before Dr. Mindbender and all that stuff.
So
he was sort of the mad scientist in the beginning, and he was so despicable and would stab you in the back at the moment's notice. And it was the whole, you know, kind of trio of him and Snake Eyes and Quinn. You know,
yeah,
sort
the
of
issue before
each
this
other
one was all about
other.
Those three.
Yes, it was magnificent. That was one of the ones I was thinking about as well, but that was a little more contained. That one is something
that was
a little more broader in G.I. Joe. This one actually doesn't have Snake. Snake Eye is probably the most famous.
Right, exactly. Yeah,
character Joe.
Been
he's not even
in
this
jail
issue.
In Miami.
Yeah. Well, who hasn't been in jail in Miami? You know, so what I wanted to ask, well, first of all, I wanted to ask, like, of that kind of group of Cobra bad guys and everything like that, did you have a favorite? Did you have someone you were like, oh, I just hope they kill this guy? Or was there someone?
No. And again, this kind of go like my reading order for the series was a little bit out of whack. But I said G.I. Joe was the first comic I ever read. Mm-hmm. And I started with issues. I always forget this. I think it's 73, 74, and 75.
Oh, okay. Right.
So for anybody who knows the series really well, this is right in the middle of the Cobra Island Civil War, which sees Cobra Commander's forces versus Serpentor's forces, with Destro having his own forces, and G.I. Joe, the government, makes them take Serpentor's side. So there are all these different factions. It's a very cool extended storyline. But that was in 1988. Mm-hmm. So that was the first time. Those were the first comics that I was reading.
Okay.
And then I would pick up the book occasionally, or I would get copies given to me from other people. I started reading the thing continuously, getting it month to month on my own, with issue 108, I think.
Oh, okay.
But once I found a dedicated comic book store in the early 90s, I would like seek out like back issues, because, you know, like as a kid, with only so much money to spare, I could go through like their quarter bins or their 50 cent bins and find some older issues and get more bang for my quarter, or my buck, or whatever it was. So I picked up a lot of issues that way, but it was very sporadic. It was very based on what they were. And like, but I would pick up like the yearbook, which was basically just what it was. It was like a catalog of all of the events that happened in the series that particular year. So that was how I learned about characters like Dr. Venom and Quinn and these guys before I got those older issues. So yeah, like at the time, it, like the characters like Scarface and Dr. Venom loomed large in my imagination before I actually read their stories.
I see.
And I think because of that, once I finally got to the point where I could read the series all the way through via the trade paperbacks and not just it's like a smattering of it, this what I called that sort of Dr. Venom saga between issue 10, which is the first time we see him and the brainwave scanner, and we get a hint of Snake Eyes' mysterious past, up until issue 19, when Quinn, Venom, Scarface, and General Flag are all killed off in this epic battle at the pit. Like between that, I think that's my favorite extended story of G.I. Joe. And I don't think it's necessarily the best. And again, like it's limited to like the second wave of characters, like the Snow Job wave with Torpedo and Gung Ho and Doc and these characters. Like this is one of my favorite eras of the characters and the figures because it was their first time branching out where, and I think, I mean, it's to kind of put this in the larger context for the listeners or the readers who aren't as familiar with this world and this franchise. I mean, most comics based on licensed toy properties, first of all, this was a new thing in the 80s. Like toy, like cartoons based on toy properties, like they had to change laws in order to get to that point that just then saturated our childhood lives in the 80s and 90s. But this was a new thing, and most comics based on toy properties, either mostly by design, but most of them were only like 4-issue miniseries or went a little bit longer. I think the Cops book, I think, went 15 issues, maybe. Transformers went 80 issues, and that was kind of like a running joke because it was supposed to be a 4-issue
It
series.
was, yeah,
And
and they just kept
on the
going,
last issue, it said issue 80 out of four out of a 4-issue miniseries. But G.I. Joe went 155 regular issues, plus the Special Missions was a sub series that went
And
28
that went,
issues.
like I was going to say, that went like 20
Yeah,
some issues,
plus the Order of Battle, which was their version of Ohotmu, like the G.I. Joe version of the official Marvel handbook.
And the
Plus,
yearbooks, yeah.
yeah, the yearbooks, other things. So there was close to 200 G.I. Joe comics produced between 1982 and 94. It was a big deal. It was a big hit. And this second year that we're in right now, at the time that this comic is coming out, is the first time I think when Larry Hama knew, like at least he had given the sanction that, hey, this toy is going to be a hit. We're going to take this toy. We've got a budget now. We can really go far and take this thing into new directions. And Larry Hama, because he had a military background and because he was also not just writing what toys they gave him, but he had a hand in shaping the characters, their personalities, their backgrounds. He was more invested in this property. He shaped it in a lot of ways. And I think that combination made this book more, like, dare I say, more serious, a more serious toy property. And this first, I kind of like this first saga, which I was saying was between issues 10 and 19, with a kind of coda in issue 22, which is like three funerals and a wedding. No, that didn't happen. But like that, I really appreciate the fact that he's really being able to stretch his legs with this particular saga, and it introduces a lot of my favorite characters, a lot of my favorite vehicles and concepts. It was just something new that was absent from the book for the first year of its existence. And it's just a lot of fun. Now, the caveat, the sub thing, and I don't know if you're going to ask me about this later, is Mike Vosburgh's art.
That was actually my next question. I was going to ask what you thought of Mike. Is it Vosburgh, Vosburgh? What?
That's a good question.
Okay, well,
Vosburgh?
we'll go with Vosburgh because it
Well,
sounded better.
I'm not even know.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not even sure. Yeah.
What did you think of his art?
Now, with everything I just said about how much I like this story arc, maybe I give him more of a pass than he deserves. The art is serviceable. It's fine. It's of a piece with what you might expect from a toy tie-in, like what you might have seen in the Centurions comic that DC published, or Mask, or something like that. It's okay. The characters are mostly on model for their toys, although I do think from page to page and panel to panel, Vosburgh could sometimes forget what Hawk's face looked like. And it's like, so sometimes those things were a little bit off. It wasn't great art, but it got the job done. G.I. Joe definitely had much better artists later on. In fact, the guys who replaced, but he was following up Herb Trimpe, who at the time was, again, maybe it's because of the material or what they thought they were doing. It was a very paint by numbers type of thing.
I thought, like, when I reread it, and again, I hadn't read a lot of these issues for a while. I thought the first, like, six, seven issues or so, the Herb Trimpe ones, read almost closer to a age, like a Shield book. You know, I mean, he was basically depicting the machinery and everything looked more like something out of, like, you know, Herb Trimpe obviously, knelt at the altar of Jack Kirby. You know, I mean, that's obvious from a lot of his designs. And it had a lot of that sort of Hydra look to it, you know, and the way that they'd all, like, salute the commander, and the way he acted, so sort of grandiose, but without kind of personality at all. Like, he wasn't really this evil, this kind of cowardly, evil, manipulating, you know, guy. He didn't have all those pieces to him yet. He was just sort of this generic evil, you know, villain, and the Baroness was more or less his right-hand man, you know, or right-hand woman. When Vosburgh came on, I'm going to give him credit for this. I thought, especially in the beginning, I thought G.I. Joe was serviced by somebody who looked like they could draw an army field manual, who looked like, you know, because all these vehicles are on point. They all look like they should look. And that's not, you know, as somebody who is an artist, that's not easy. It's not easy
No.
to do that. And
Vehicles and technology are a different skill
yes,
set than drawing a person.
absolutely. And he has that down. Like you said, his depictions of people and faces and stuff like that, you know, it was fine cartooning. I thought he was a pretty decent storyteller. I mean, you weren't gonna mistake, him for, for George Perez or anything like that, or John Byrne or anybody else. But I thought pretty much for what they were trying to do, he was a good person for the job. And I think he got across everything he needed to get across. You know, Larry Hama is a star. It was the star of this book from 1 to 155 and everything in between. I mean, the writing and the depictions of these people is what sold it. I don't remember there ever being a superstar artist on G.I. Joe. I mean, Rod Wingham, maybe.
Ron
But
Wagner does a good job, but he
Ron
was a
Wagner,
nobody and
sorry, I don't
didn't
know
do
why
it.
I said Wing. And some of those guys.
Todd McFarlane does draw an issue.
Oh,
I
that's right. Yeah,
don't think it was
well,
anything special, and I don't hold him in high regard in terms of artist, but
but
in
yes,
terms
he
of
is a
a name, he's
superstar
the
artist. Yeah.
biggest name who drew the book.
But I mean, somebody who did a long run on, I guess. You know, there weren't too many super, you know, like people you think of now. You know what I mean? But yeah, I thought he was fine. I understand what you're saying. It's not sexy. It's not, you know, or anything like that. But I thought he got the job done. You know, and it didn't detract from my enjoyment of the book.
Yeah,
You
there you
know,
go.
and there are artists who sometimes do that. You kind of, like, take away from it a little bit, and I don't think he did that. So,
To your earlier point, when you mentioned like the sort of Shield comparison, this is the sort of legendary story, and people, even if they don't follow G.I. Joe, they may kind of know this just for sort of comic book osmosis. Larry Hama pitched a Nick Fury and Agents of Shield comic to Marvel when he was an editor in 1980 or 81. And Jim Shooter was like, no, we're not going to do that. We don't have room for that and everything. And then when Hasbro came to him with this show, like this toy property about an army team, they're like, will you do a comic about these army? Jim Shooter remembered Larry Hama's Shield pitch. And he was like, hey, do you want to take a whack at this one? And Larry repurposed some of his ideas for that. So that's why those first couple issues feel like it's Shield versus Hydra,
Right.
because he
Okay.
was taking the ideas that he had for that and
Gotcha.
redressing them with G.I. Joe and Cobra.
Gotcha. Okay, that makes sense. Now, did you read? We kind of talked about the Marvel. So I want to get back to that too. Just while I'm thinking of it, did you read any of like the Image, IDW, Devil's Due, any of
I
those
did.
runs?
I was excited when that came back because
Yeah.
I was in college at that time, and that series when Devil's Due Publishing brought it back for the first time after like 6 or 7 years, and it came out right. I think one of the issues dropped on September 11th, 2001, like
Oh, wow.
an event. So it was like, whew. So it was like not only that big event, but it was also a weird time for patriotism and nationalism in the country. So to see
Yeah,
a G.I.
yeah.
Joe book on the stands kind of gave it this extra boost. I was excited to see that then. I was like, oh yeah, this kind of rekindled my love for it. I didn't stick with it for that long. Just something about it didn't feel the way I want to. And then when IDW got the property, they did something where Chuck Dixon was writing the book,
Right. Yep.
and I gave that one a shot, but for some reason it wasn't feeling like it should have. And then they brought back the Larry Hama continuity. They brought back G.I. Joe, a real American hero,
Yes.
with issue 156
Yeah.
and had him pick up where he left
And
off.
that's still
And
going on. That's
that felt
still
like
going
coming home.
on.
It
Yeah.
is. It is. They're now,
Yeah.
in like
We're
the
like 300 and
320s.
something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's still going on.
Right.
Now it's under the Skybound imprint of Image. So yeah. But that. So this will be a tangent, and I don't know if you want to keep this in or delete it, but like the Chuck Dixon run kind of crystallized this idea that I had, where for stories, like when a writer attacks a existing property or franchise or something, they're going to tell a story within this world that is licensed or something like that. There's kind of two different tracks you can do. You can tell a story baked in that universe based on that lore and your love and your appreciation for that, or you can tell a story that you want to tell about something important to you and use that world as your set dressing, as your
Right.
method. And I don't think either one is necessarily good or bad, but like the comparison in terms of G.I. Joe I would use is that I think Chuck Dixon wanted to write a story about geopolitics and espionage and basically a James Bond team with that type of like a world crisis thing, and just use G.I. Joe for that as a vehicle for that story.
Are
But he
you saying
wasn't.
that Chuck Dixon is the Tom King of G.I. Joe? Is that
Are
what
you finding a
you're
connection between
telling
those two? Maybe.
me?
Yeah, but yeah, so his fidelity to the source material wasn't necessarily what a long-term fan might have been looking for.
Oh.
For instance,
But
he
he
would.
also wasn't really beholden to the toys at that point either.
No,
I mean, that's
because
the thing. I
they
mean,
weren't making toys at that point, so he
you
had
couldn't be
total
like,
autonomy.
yeah,
Right.
in like issue 20, you couldn't kill off Gung Ho because they're like, what the hell? It's one of our best-selling toys. You can't,
Right, right.
stuff like that. You can't
But
kill it out. But at this point, you could kind of do a lot
right.
more,
But the G.I. Joe comic being published right now, the one that Larry Hama isn't writing, but the one that
Right.
Joshua Williamson, who's
Yes.
also writing Superman and a bunch of DC books, he's writing the G.I. Joe book for Skybound right now. And you can tell he has a G.I. Joe story to tell. The
Gotcha.
story he's telling is the DNA of G.I. Joe is influencing his story decisions and the way he treats the characters. It's a more adult and sophisticated story, but it's based on that. And as a fan, you can say that I like Joshua Williamson's version because it's respecting what I love about it,
Right.
whereas Chuck Dixon is just using the trappings of G.I. Joe for his story. But that isn't to say that Chuck Dixon's story or his approach to it is necessarily inferior, because if we can step away from G.I. Joe, I think the show Andor, the Disney Plus Star Wars show Andor, I think that was the showrunner, I forget his name, but that was a show that was about what's happening in our society. It's about life under an oppressive government. It's about tyranny, it's about resistance, and it's about protest culture and racial profiling and all of these things. And it just happens to be set in the world of Star Wars. But it's not like a Star Wars story. And I think
Right.
that's why it connects with a lot of people who aren't Star Wars fans.
Yeah.
So
Yeah.
again, these are two different approaches, and one might not be better than the other. It just kind of depends on who the fan is and what the fan expects from this.
Yeah. Yeah. I collected most of those series. The one that I probably found the most fascinating was, I don't know if you read any of the Cobra series. It was just called Cobra. And then the second one. And that was one basically was focused on Chuckles.
Yeah,
Chuckles was a nothing character from the original, you know, GI Joe. Yeah, guy wore like a Hawaiian shirt, supposed to be like
a CIA agent
basically working with him. And that got really grim and very serious.
Yeah,
it did.
Oh, yeah.
And actually, spoiler alert for anybody who hasn't read it, ends with the assassination of the Cobra Commander. He kills the Cobra Commander and then blows up Zay and dies himself.
Yep.
And but it's fantastic. It's a great read. But again, I guess they were like, okay, we're going to take this one character nobody cares about anyway, and kind of do what we want, you know. So that was sort of interesting. And some of the choices he has to make, some very grim choices he has to make.
Kill his handler, who was a beloved G.I. Joe character. Yeah.
Was really interesting, but sorry, we're straying away a little bit from the Marvel line, but I had to ask about that while we were there. So, was there anything like, I want to talk more G.I. Joe, but I want to ask first about this particular story that we read. Is there anything in particular you wanted to talk more about this?
Showing a little bit of its age, the first exchange between Scarlet and Cover Girl, who were at the time the first female, and these are both strong characters. Scarlet is one of the best characters.
Yes.
Actually, Baroness is one of my favorite characters, but these two are very strong, like the strongest possible characters you get in this very macho masculine book.
Right.
The female characters have always been excellent.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the first exchange between our first two Joe characters, Scarlet and Cover Girl, they're just bickering and sniping at each other. And I read that scene again. And I was like, this would certainly not pass the Bechdel test.
No, it wouldn't. But they moved on from that. And I will give, I definitely always give Larry Hama credit for G.I. Joe had to be one of the most diverse books, cartoons, toy lines on the market. That you had, you know, Native Americans, and you had African Americans, and you had Latinos, and you had, you know, you know, you had women, you had, you know, you kind of across the bound. Not everybody was a generic white man.
Yeah. So to his credit, the cartoon picked that up too for a lot of kids. And I was watching the cartoon before I ever read the comic. Mm-hmm. And I remember like the prominence of characters like Roadblock and Lady J and Scarlet, like the fact that these were people of color or women who were strong and competent and heroic. I was like, that had an influence on me and my worldview. So it was good.
And from the jump, basically Stalker was kind of second in command. You know, so they didn't shy away from that stuff at all. And I thought that was great. Yeah. So I'm trying to think if there's anything else I really wanted to say about it. It was a fun issue. There was a lot going on. It was terrific. It was a great introduction. This was kind of that time, like you said, they were starting to introduce that sort of second wave of a lot of the toys, you know, like Piece by Piece and Boom Boom Boom. You know, we had already met like Snowjob and Doc and Wild Bill
Gung-ho.
And everything. Gung Ho, Airborne. Ooh,
I gotta say, I don't love the way Chris Claremont handles the Cajun dialect with Gambit. But it is miles better than what we get from Gung Ho from time to time.
Yeah, it was a bit. In this comic. That was a bit much. Yeah, that was a bit much.
He's just throwing case cassé because he knows that phrase in French. Like, there's no reason for that line.
Pretty much, yes. So, going back. So again, we're both obviously great lovers of G.I. Joe and the whole genre and everything. So, and you in particular, you know, have been a big toy collector for this now. Did you have, now I know you're collecting more of the newer versions of everything. Did you have a lot of the old action figures as well? Like who?
Yeah. Like I said,
who was your first, do you remember who your very first, or maybe you got a couple at the same time or something like that? Like who was first?
So like I said, I inherited the line from my brother and he was collecting it from the beginning. So the first wave in 1982, he was getting them.
Okay.
And I do remember just sort of like looking over his shoulder, being a fan of these things. And I think I liked Flash because he was the laser guy and he was the most colorful. He had these orange or red pads on his shoulders and his legs. So he was the most toyetic for a little kid.
Yeah.
So I liked him. And then like Blowtorch for the same reason, the firefighter who was, or the flame fire, flamethrower guy who was all red and yellow for the same reason as a little kid. I think the first toys that I got that were like for me, and I wasn't just playing with my brother's toys. I think Barbecue was my first,
Oh, okay.
who was the firefighter. He was all, again, same reason. He was all in red. He looked more toyetic. He kind of had this weird kind of futuristic thing. It was either him or Quick Kick.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And then I read, because that was the 1985 line. And then I distinctly remember that Christmas. Like, and again, these were mostly his, but I was kind of like getting them sort of secondhand, like the snowcat vehicle and the tactical battle platform playset.
Oh, yeah.
But then the year after that, 1986, was the first year where G.I. Joe became my thing. And that was the
Okay.
year with Sergeant Slaughter and
Okay.
Serpentor and
Like when
like
the
that whole
movie came
and
out and everything.
right.
Yeah.
And basically like that from that point on, I was getting almost all of the figures. I wouldn't get
Okay.
every vehicle. I would usually get one big vehicle from that year, but not a lot of the little ones. But a ton of the figures. And then that I stuck with it until the early 90s, when I was probably close to junior high or middle school, when I was the tool, like I was getting the ridiculous subgroups like the Eco Warriors and Star Brigade, and in the 90s when every character was neon, and you're like, how is this a military thing anymore? And I remember like going to, I think it was either a Walmart or a Kmart, and going to the toy aisle and holding in my hand a figure called Ice Cream Soldier. That was the name of the character, and he was
I don't
bright
know who
orange.
that
And I held him and I said, I think I've outgrown this. And I put it back on the shelf and said goodbye. Little did I know at the time, that was the last Joe Pub produced in
Oh, really?
for the real American Hero line. Like
Oh,
that was the
wow.
last guy they made. Like I think at that point they knew we've killed this property.
Yeah. That's funny. Yeah. I wanted to backtrack for a second too, because you were talking about you went to like Kmart or Walmart or something like that. The very first issues I ever got of G.I. Joe were actually in a pack, in like the pack you get at a
Oh,
department
yeah.
store. And it was the second printing of 3, 4, and 5.
Okay.
Like the second printings, but they're all in a pack. And that was my introduction to G.I. Joe. Actually, I
Nice.
think before I'd seen a cartoon or an action figure or anything, that was kind of my introduction. A lot of the ones you're talking about, I'm older than you, so I'd kind of aged out by that point. So my memory is more of like the original guys. And that was sort of, if you want to nod to Rob Kelly, that was sort of my Mountain Comics. This was my
No, I
Jersey
get it. I get
Shore.
it.
These were like my Jersey Shore toys.
Yeah.
We'd go to the boardwalk, and there'd always be a like one of the places that had like toys and stuff like that. And I remember getting, I had Zap
Oh, yeah.
and Flash, and I'm trying to remember, I had a couple of the original. Yeah, I had Zap. I remember Zap and Flash, and I had Grunt, and I had one other one that I can't remember. It may have been a Cobra Soldier, and those were like the
Okay.
first like four I had or something like that. So, and I just thought they were the coolest things ever. Zap had the bazooka and everything like that, and they were, and I sort of intermixed them with other toys I had or action figures and stuff like that. But I just thought they were the coolest thing. I just thought they were so neat. And then I started reading comics, and I remember I got the glider,
Yeah,
that another that also came with a grunt, but he had like
He was tan. It was a
tan,
tan
yeah, like
reprint.
tan fatigues, yeah. And I had Wild Bill and the helicopter, and I didn't have too many. I had the Vamp with Clutch, and that was, I didn't have a ton of the toys. I had Zartan, when he came with the with his little with his
The
uh
swamp
with
skier
his
thing,
swamp skier thing, yeah. And when he would, you put him out in the sun and he'd
So then he
change
changed color,
color.
which is a technology I still don't know how
Yeah,
they
I don't
did.
know. It probably was radioactive. I don't know at the time. But I actually still, so I had a lot of the originals and still have them. Actually, I have them in a box. And I, at one point, so we got rid of the storage unit and moved everything over here. And I was like, I should bag these up and sell them. So I bagged them up individually, and I was going to go to a place not too far from DC that bought and sold them. And the next day, I come downstairs and my son was up in the attic and he was playing with all of them. He had all of them out of the bags and everything. And I was like, well, I guess I'm about to sell them now. I was like, this is better anyway. I'd rather him, you know, play with these and everything. So I've shown him some of the episodes on like YouTube and stuff like that, the old cartoon and everything. But go ahead.
I love that. And nostalgia is a weird thing for me because I am still beloved and beholden to this property. But not necessarily the way I experienced it as a child. Because like I said, like 1986 was when it became my property. And that was the Sergeant Slaughter years and like the eras after that. But my love for it is really confined to the era before that. And I think part of that was the cartoons, because that was such a big part of it. The cartoon era was the years before that with Duke and Flint and and like those characters, the first 4 years of the line. And yeah, with comics, it's weird. Like I started reading X-Men comics with Mark Silvestri and Jim Lee on art. I don't like those comics anymore. I don't like reading those. I go back and read the eras before that with like Paul Smith and John Byrne and Dave Cockrum before that. And like, I started reading comics in the late 80s and early 90s. I don't love 90s comics. I have no nostalgia for those with a few Batman exceptions. But like my love is for the 1970s Marvel horror stuff. I didn't read that until like three decades later. And G.I. Joe is kind of the same way. Like my focus, my love for it is really the era before I was a regular collector. And like when I kind of like mentioned like, after like when I got out of college and I had a little bit of my own income and I discovered eBay, I went back and bought a bunch of the Joes from those first couple years, like those original Joes, like up to like the 1985 line, like a bunch of those. Like, and those were precious to me. But then when I had Reese, I was like, you know what? I'm not displaying these. I'm never going to sell them. They're not in great shape, so I don't think they have a ton of value. It was like, I'm just going to see if he wants to play with them and see if maybe we can forge a connection there. And that is how I discovered that the original 1982 Joes were made from a much more inferior plastic than all the figures after that, because so many of those original ones just got broken by his little 3-year-old grubby hands.
It's the same way. A lot of them appear. Most of like my older ones are, their thumbs are gone and stuff like that. You know, they couldn't hold a weapon if he wanted, you know, if you wanted to put one in. I did buy like a little bag of those rubber bands so I could do the surgery on them. So when those, you know, because again,
rubber bands,
these rubber bands are like 40 years old. So they've snapped, you know, and I'm like, so I have to like unscrew them and you got to get it in there and then sort of close it up, but keep the arms in and everything to get it all.
And God help you if that little screw is rusted or stripped and you can never open that figure, then you're done. Then it's just throw that one away.
Then you're screwed. But so did you, I know you collect now, but when you first started, you got your brother stuff and everything. How did you play with them? Like, did you make elaborate storylines? Did you combine them with Star Wars?
Oh, sure.
Figures?
Yeah.
Were there other kids? Did you know other kids that played with them?
Yeah, that was the great thing. Like when and where I grew up, a lot of my friends were collecting them too. And I had one of my best friends at that time, kind of like in third and fourth grade, which would have been like early or late 80s, early 90s. He had a giant sandbox at his house and everything that. And we would like take the hose and use it to like kind of flood part of it to create running water. Would do all that. We wasted so much water. His dad got so mad at us. but we would combine our collections. Like he would get some toys so that I wouldn't have to get those vehicles because we would share. And somehow a lot of them ended up at my house anyway. So my collection looked much bigger than it really should have been. There was less of a narrative structure to it than there was just like, we would take a day setting up the playset, like where everybody was stationed, positioning all of the guys, like what were the front lines? Where was like the MASH tent, the medical unit? Where were they based? Like who was the stealth recon team sneaking up behind the
You're
back of
almost
it.
playing like Risk or Stratego with them or
Yeah,
something like
like it was a board game. And
that.
we would spend a day setting that up, and it was like then the sun is going down, we have to go home. And then the next day we would come back and let it all just like play the whole thing out like over hours at a time and then reset the next day. And it's just like that was, and then like yeah, I went through that phase, then getting older and a little bit more cynical, still collecting G.I. Joe toys, obviously, but being more cynical and like, okay, I don't care about the heroes. I want to play the Cobras now. Now I want the Cobras to win. And I'm gonna have the bad guys kill all of the good guys because that's gonna be cool. So it's just it was a weird thing.
So like I said, I was just sort of the original, and I sort of aging out of it. But I didn't really like, I played sports and stuff as a kid and everything. We did the whole, did the whole rotation. Did soccer in the fall, did basketball in the winter, did baseball in the spring. So most of my friends were in sports and everything. Not too many of them were really into the activity. So I pretty much was on my own with that. So I pretty much played my. Now, the one thing I distinctly remember is every year around Christmas time, we get out the Christmas decorations. My family, we had a nativity scene, and we weren't particularly religious people, but we had gotten this at some point, and it may have been somebody's grandmother's or something like that. So it would always be set out, and I would create these elaborate setups of battles around the nativity scene, and like the baby Jesus was the MacGuffin at some point, so there was some like power source within the baby Jesus. So
He
they
fuels the
would,
mass of us.
yes, they'd all be like sort of around it. Somehow it would migrate to the Christmas tree at some point,
Yes, of
toward
course,
closer
yeah.
to Christmas, where they'd be all climbed, they'd try have to get to the top of the star or something. That would be the weather dominator. I don't know, something like that, Snake Eyes is up there battling Storm Shadow or something like that. So, I would have that, but I'd also sometimes just set up like this really elaborate battle scene. Like when I was done playing, I'd just set it up and leave it there like overnight and everything like that. And my mom thought it was a little strange and everything, but I think my, but again, we weren't that religious family. I don't think anybody was offended. And I hope nobody's offended by this. Again, this is just a little kid, being stupid.
I
But,
mean, we're saying the blood of Christ is powerful, is like a super weapon to kill all things.
Well, basically it was like
No, I
plutonium. But
no,
my Nana wasn't too happy about it, when she saw it. But other than that, everybody was pretty good
I
with it.
love that story because G.I. Joe in the Christmas tree was a family tradition that I continue to this day. We always, every time we put up a Christmas tree and we decorated it with ornaments and decorations, all these things that my mom wanted us to put up. After that was over, me and sometimes my brother would join me. We would put G.I. Joes around the tree and we would have a battle with them fighting like that was their forest. And inevitably, we would lose a figure in there. And we wouldn't know what happened to that figure until like January 1st or 2nd when
You
we
taking
took the tree down and it would
the
just fall out of them. And I was like, that's what happened to Beachhead.
down, yeah.
So it's like,
That's funny.
and I still do that to this, I this to this day, every Christmas, I grab a few of the ones from my kids' box with the old figures and I'll just set them up.
Oh yeah, that's awesome. I should probably do that. I don't know, but I know somewhere I have a photo of the nativity scene with all the G.I. Joes, and I cannot find it for the life of me. If I ever do, I'll put it on
That's
the
good.
up on the network. But beyond the toys, I almost feel like I want to talk the show too, but that's almost its own thing. I feel like we need to get back together and talk about the show. Maybe
Oh,
sometime we can do it on the Saturday Morning Fever or something like
yeah,
that.
that'll refine your joke. We'll do something.
Yeah,
We'll find a way to talk about
exactly. But so I want to keep it
it.
to the
Clearly,
topic.
I can talk about this for a long time.
So I maybe a year or two ago actually sold my entire G.I. Joe collection, my Marvel G.I. Joe collection. I actually got a pretty decent price for it.
Nice.
155 went got a very good price for it, and I had no idea. I guess because at that point nobody was buying it, so they didn't print that many. And that one in particular, because towards the end it was basically just all ninjas.
Yes.
They more or less, I know for a certain amount of time it was basically Snake Eyes and the
That was
Ninja
the masthead.
Squad or
Like
something like
they
that. That was the
rebranded it,
masthead, and
yeah.
G.I. Joe was sort of the smaller.
They
It
were an
was almost,
afterthought.
it was almost like a Superboy and a Legion thing in reverse or something like that. So I was buying it. I missed some issues here and there. But But yeah, I had, I'd say of the 155 issues, I probably had maybe 130 of them or something like that,
Okay, that's good.
140 of them.
Good question. Yeah.
And sold it off. And sometimes I regret it because I really like it. You know, I really enjoyed it. Are there certain storylines that you remember? Again, I know you were kind of going back and forth because you were buying
Yeah, I
things at
know.
certain times. Were there certain
Yes.
storylines? Were there certain characters that you were like, I love this character? Yeah.
First, before I forget, I love your story about like you not getting or the value for that final issue, because what you said, my story of leaving the comic, of kind of aging out of the comic, mirrors my story of aging out of the action figures. I mentioned how I held Ice Cream Soldier and said, I think I'm done with this, and put him back, little knowing that was the last figure they made for the line. I was collecting the comic, and I wasn't enjoying the last like year or so, like after after they brought in like Transformers Generation 2 or something like that, and then they just had these issues. I don't care about this anymore, but I just kept on getting out of habit. And I think with issue 154, I found it at the Eagle Grocery, picked it up, and just said, "Nope, I don't like this book anymore. I'm not feeling it." And I put 154 back on the stand. Didn't know 155 would be the last issue. Never saw that one in the stores. Never read that until I saw it in the trade paperback either. So,
Have you
out
read
of
it?
the,
Have you read 155?
I
Have
have
you?
now
Okay,
in trade. So, out of the 155 like regular issues plus all like nearly 200 issues, I think I probably had about 100, maybe more at the peak. And then my basement flooded at one point when I had all of the comics out of their plastic, just sitting on the ground. And I think I lost about 30 of them.
Oh,
So today in my parents' basement in Illinois, I think I still have 60 or 70. But I lost some good ones. To your question, I like the story that we're talking about with this particular issue. This is in the middle of kind of like one of my favorite sagas. I really liked the whole, it was like issues, it was in the like the late 40s, like 47 through 50, which had Ripcord going to Cobra Island because his girlfriend was kidnapped. He didn't realize she'd actually been killed. She'd been killed, but her dad was a Crimson Guard. So Ripcord goes to Cobra Island, and then Zartan, he fights Zartan, and they Zartan impersonates Ripcord so that he can go back to Joe headquarters and find out where the pit is. And then Ripcord gets taken to Springfield so he can find out where that location is. But amongst that, while that is going on, Snake Eyes and Storm Shadow figure out who killed the Hard Master. They're like master and everything. So they go to Cobra Island to get that same information. And then that like culminates with Storm Shadow being shot dead by the Baroness. Now he gets better, like because of shenanigans with Serpentor. But like, yeah, there was just a lot of stuff. Like the Cobra Island Civil War, which is in the middle of the 70s, like 72 through 76, was a great story. There were some awesome stories in the 50s and 60s dealing more with like the Gulag storyline, when Stalker, Snowjob, and Quick Kick are in a
Yes, I
prison
was going to
in
mention
Eastern
that.
Europe.
I was going to
That was a
mention that.
great
Yes.
storyline.
It actually
But
it tied over into Special Missions,
yes, showed how
and then
Outback
back.
escaped.
Back Escape. That was terrific. I really like that part.
Those were like, they definitely got to a more sophisticated point in time during that, where Larry was really allowed to kind of go some interesting places. And maybe that was just because of like the me, I don't know, maybe like post Vietnam. I mean, we're in the late 80s, but like maybe like just the ideas of America's military had kind of shifted in that decade. But then with the 90s, when we go into Operation Desert Storm, things change. And
Can
then
be a little
G.I.
more,
Joe has this whole mission in the Middle East, in this fake country called Trucial Abyssinia, where a bunch of other Joes get killed off in this big storyline. So
the Saw Viper guns them all down, and then Snake Eyes gets in.
My sweet spot definitely is issues 11 through 50. Basically, once they the bat culminating in the Battle of Springfield, once they actually move on to Cobra Island, I like the stories. They're good stories. I just don't love them as much as some of the others. But so.
I was never a big fan of Serpentor, so while I liked the build up to him, I once he was there, I didn't like I was always a big fan of Cobra Commander, to be honest with you. I mean, I know
Yeah,
he was
absolutely.
just, he was, you know, this despicable, sniveling, conniving, you know, cowardly, you know, evil guy, but he, there, you know, he was at the same point, he was very entertaining. And
yeah,
and they kind of sidelined him and made him like more of a toady once Serpentor was there. And I didn't like that. I, you know, it didn't, it felt like there was no place for him at that point. It was almost at that point, I was like, just kill him off or something like that, because it didn't make any sense.
I think part of that was the influence of the cartoon kind of shaped what, like the feeling about, okay, this character is kind of like an incompetent whiner and everything. We need a more serious alpha villain. But
But I agree. The Ripcord, the whole Ripcord saga was terrific. I again, I mentioned before the whole Dr. Venom, Quinn, Snake Eyes saga in the early issues was terrific. And I just overall, I really liked Special Missions series, just because it was sort of this bottled, you know, these bottled episodes, so to speak. You know, I think one or two of them might have been two-parters, but for the most part, it was just, and they could focus on random people that way, you know, and outside of the way. You could have one that was just about, oh, the Ace Wild Weasel issue. It was a terrific issue, too, where they had the dogfight. That was in the regular series, I think. But
that was issue 34.
Yeah, something like that. But it was just a great time for that comic. You know, Larry Hama was just, like you said, from the beginning through 50 or 60, he was you know, running on all cylinders, and it was just such a fun comic. And like you mentioned, you learned so much. I mean, half the time it was so funny, especially in the early parts of the series, they'd be I have to go out. Let me put on the jump, and then they'd spell out to you what jump stood for. You know, like the rocket pack that Stalker always got, and stuff like that. And it was fun because, like you said, you learned a lot of military lingo that way. And he was able to have serious storylines, but keep it fun. And always with a nod and a wink, you know, realize that, look, I realize some of these people look ridiculous and everything, but it doesn't, you know, just enjoy the ride, you know, just kind of enjoy the ride. And he was able to both respect the military and kind of poke fun at it a little bit too. Part of that was he was a Vietnam veteran. He was a military man. So, it was fascinating. You learned a lot, and it was just so much fun. I really
enjoyed it. And again, for anybody who never gave it a chance or doesn't really know, like it's not so different from Silver or Bronze Age superhero team books. I mean, in the sense, like, if you look at like the Silver Age Justice League stories, all the characters sound the exact same. You can take a word balloon and swap who's saying it, and it doesn't matter. And G.I. Joe was kind of like that, where only a handful of characters had real defined personalities or backstories and everything. A lot of it was just like, okay, anybody, any Joe, any one of the 200 characters could be on this particular mission saying this particular line. But the one that they choose adds a little bit of color or a little bit of intrigue and everything like that. And every year, like, it kind of like there was this crazy kind of natural sense of momentum that the book had because of the action, because of the toy property, because every year they were putting out new product, new toys, and Larry had to introduce those characters. So every single issue of a book introduces a new character or a new vehicle or a new theme or a new element or something like that. The book never got stagnant until the 2000s, when the toy line isn't moving it for anymore. Now, unfortunately, I think it's been spinning its wheels for over a decade. But yeah, there was just this very interesting sense of momentum where they could just pull you along because there's a new, fresh face every day. But you know, there's always like Snake Eyes and Stalker and Scarlet to anchor it, like and Storm Shadow. That family unit, that connection is kind of at the heart of it. That will tie you back.
I agree. It's a wonderful, and I'm so happy you it's G.I. Joe, when you did this, because again, just reading those early issues just brought back this flood of memories and everything. I was like, wow, this is so much fun. And I went on Comixology and basically bought the first compendium, which is the first 50 issues. So I just read up to 16 before we recorded. So I have that fresh in my mind. I haven't read past there yet, but you know, I can't wait. I'm so excited to just read through there because it's just so much fun. And I'd say the other thing I wanted to mention was, now you said that you know, for the most part, you can interchange the word bubbles and stuff. But if you did want a more of a sense of the personalities, the one of the coolest things about the whole G.I. Joe collection was the toys was on the back. They have their
card,
the file card, which would have their, you know, their name and rank and all that stuff. And like what they're, like I mentioned at the beginning of the thing, if you're still familiar with NATO and Warsaw Pact small arms, because pretty much every character was. But you know, it'd say like what their specialties was and go into detail, like what languages they spoke. Right. And then it would have a little thing on their dossier that kind of lended to their personality. Yes, yeah. Lended to their personality. Like how Roadblock was this tough guy who could literally carry around a Browning 50 caliber machine gun.
And notable that Grand Slam reads comic books and escapist fiction.
Yeah.
It was like that was a thing.
Yeah.
Those files are
cooked too, you know, and exactly. One of them, you know, short fuse, obviously has a short fuse and stuff like that.
Right.
By the way, Grand Slam and Flash looked exactly the same. I don't think there was any difference between the two of them. They had the red patches and everything. Uh-huh. You're like, what do you at least make one of them a different color or something like that?
They did when the next year they redid Grand Slam with silver pads because they wanted to differentiate them. So the second chance they did that.
Okay.
But yeah, those file cards were written by Larry Hama. When he was breaking down the book, he basically made these little note cards with a tiny little bio of all the characters so he could keep them straight. And Hasbro was like, "What are you doing with those?" And he kind of showed them what he had. And they're like, "That's a good idea. We should have those to kind of," because the characters, like, if you look at the packaging for the first couple of years, the emphasis was on the specialty, not the code name. It said, like, the picture was like Machine Gunner, and in smaller font, code name Rock and Roll.
Yes,
And
you're
that's
right.
how it was for
You're
the
right.
first couple of years. The emphasis was on the specialty because they were basically just, these were just army men. They're just making of a new specialty. Oh, this is the bazooka soldier. What's his name? I don't know, Zap, I guess, whatever. And then after a couple of years, like once the cartoon and the comic made these characters successful, they're like, oh, okay, who is this? Lowlight
Right.
specialty, sniper or night spotter, because sniper was
Yeah, couldn't
complicated.
put
I
that
don't know.
on there. No, you're right. And it was, yeah, that was so much fun. And I cut them all out, obviously. You know,
Me
I
too.
mean, everybody, and again, they're up in the box with the toys, you know, and Owen's got them all over the place now. But yeah, I always liked that. I have to ask too, did you ever, this might have been, by the time you're collecting, they might not have been doing this anymore, but did you ever have to order away
Yeah.
for a
The f you
character?
use the flag points to
Yeah,
order
yeah,
someone
yeah. Who,
special.
what did you get? Who did you get?
Gosh. 'Cause by the time I was doing that, they weren't, I don't think they were offering like new product that way. Like that was the first way you could get Duke or Doc or characters like that. I think by the time I was using that, it was to get characters that were no longer being made. I don't remember. I never got like a lot of the special ones. Like I never had the fridge, even though I grew up in the Chicago Bears.
Yeah, how could you
They
not have
were my
the
team, and I watched William Perry, but I never had the fridge figure.
Forgot about the fridge. Yeah, they got a little ridiculous with some of the characters after a while.
They did. Oh, but the favorite, like apocryphal thing is if you read Order of Battle issue 2, there's a G.I. Joe entry for Rocky
Yes,
Balboa because
I
Hasbro
know.
was in negotiations with Sylvester Stallone about getting a figure based on Rocky, and instead he signed a deal with somebody else to make Rambo action figures, and they never actually produced the Rocky figure.
I recall. I think there was one or two. I remember the Rocky, and there might have been one or two other ones in that order of battle that didn't get made. I'm trying to remember, but yes, I had those, and I was like, what the hell is this? But anyway, yeah, so I got two of them, the early on ones. I got the Cobra Commander with his hood on. I got the hooded Cobra Commander, and I got Duke, real early. Yeah, there was sort of like two of the ones real early on that they had, and those are the only ones I got ordered. But yeah, it's great. But before we get to last call and the questions and everything, is there anything else you wanted to impart any wisdom about G.I. Joe or anything else you wanted to say ahead of time?
Gosh,
we have more Joe stuff coming. Don't worry.
I feel like I've said a lot. And again, I could also do an entire podcast about this property, I think. Nothing off the top of my head. Okay. I think I finished my drink, so it was obviously a lot better than I thought it was when I first sipped it.
See? All right. Well, in that case, we are moving on. It's last call. In this segment, I asked my insightful guest Ryan some thought-provoking questions that came to me as I prepared for the show. I asked the questions. Ryan fascinates us all with his answers. As always, Ryan has been told ahead of time, fantastic questions 1 and 2, and then there will be a mystery fantastic question at the end. So, fantastic question number 1. Cobra is bringing back the Weather Dominator and have to retrieve pieces in the Arctic, the Caribbean, and London. Choose your 3 5-person Joe teams, that's 15 Joes, to stop Cobra. Extra credit if you want to name the Cobra agents at each location as well. Have at
it. I love this damn question. As soon as I read, first of all, it wasn't just your choice of comics were eerily close to my favorite comics, like that we could have gone from the series. But the Weather Dominator miniseries, the Revenge of Cobra, is my favorite cartoon in G.I. Joe. Like, that's my favorite storyline. So I was like, oh, yeah. And I love making lists, and I love making up, like, these teams, like, that I would have done when I was a kid. So I did come up with my 3 teams.
All right.
And I, based on my own preference and my own kind of bias for the era, I limited the figures to like the first 4 years, the 1982 to 1985 waves. So basically the same characters that appeared in the original cartoon series.
Oh, very good.
All right. So my Arctic unit, my Arctic team, starting pretty obviously with Snowjob, he will be on the team. Of course. A character who, based on the file cards that we were talking about, is from Rutland, Vermont, a city only about 2 hours from where I am right now.
Okay.
And also, for other comic book fans, they'll remember that Rutland, Vermont's Halloween parade played an important part of various issues of Marvel and DC in like the late 70s. For some reason, all of the comic creators would go there. Not 70s, 60s, I think. Anyway, Snowjob would be on the team. Mm-hmm. Frostbite as the other winter guy from that era who drove the Snowcat. So they would have that as a vehicle. I would have Alpine.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Does Snowjob have his snowmobile with him? The polar bear?
Yeah. We'd have that. Yeah. Although, you know, he really works better on skis. So maybe we just.
That's true. Yeah. He's so much cooler on skis.
Yeah.
So that's true. Okay. Sorry. Go ahead.
I would have Alpine on this unit because I've always loved Alpine. He is the mountain specialist, which sounds kind of weirdly specific, but I also think it makes him kind of strangely ubiquitous because. Mm-hmm. As a mountaineer, you can put him with an Arctic team, like he's climbing glaciers. You can also put him with a desert team, like he's climbing the Hindu Kush Mountains in Pakistan or something, or in a jungle. He kind of works everywhere.
You can put him in an urban team if he has to scale like a building or something.
Absolutely.
Like that.
You can
put him anywhere. Yeah. Yeah. I love Alpine. That's awesome.
And then just we saw them in this way in the cartoon, and we need kind of like a field leader. I would have Flint and Lady J in that team.
Oh, okay.
Just dress them up in their winter gear. The Arctic team would be Flint, Lady J, Snowjob, Frostbite, and Alpine. And then the Cobra in charge of this field of battle, it would be Destro with his henchman Scrap Iron, who was the guy who tested all of Mars's weapons. So I would have them.
I love Scrap Iron, an underrated villain.
He was great.
Cool. Yeah. I love that team.
Right. For the Caribbean team, need Torpedo, and now he has no reason to wear his his scuba gear, his fins, and his rebreather if he needs to be in the water, you know, fighting skeleton pirates at the bottom of the sea, whatever it is. But yeah, Torpedo would be there. We would have Gung Ho as the Marine. He also kind of fits that theme. Cutter would be their vehicle specialist operating
Oh,
the
yeah.
killer whale.
Yep.
Cutter's the Coast Guardsman, but he drives the hovercrafts. They need that. Because the Caribbean also includes islands with a jungle environment, I would have Ricando as one of the specialists there, one of my favorites. And then Spirit also as a tracker familiar with
Yes.
the jungle environment.
Yep.
Also, because of the Central American idea. I mean, he is a from Southwestern Native America, so it's not the same thing, but maybe there would be some kind of crossover with that. And
Love it.
then for that environment, the two Cobras in charge would be Zartan, obviously, and then Copperhead, one of my favorite villains in terms of the
Nice.
with the water moccasin. So that
Very
gives you
good.
a jungle and aquatic theme right
Yeah,
there between those two.
absolutely. Well, Copperhead was they had their thing wasn't as big as the whale, right? The Copperhead
No, the water
vehicle, but
moccasin
the
wasn't. It
water
was like
moccasin was there. That was
half the
more for
size,
like
but
the bayou and stuff like that. Yeah, it was a smaller
right.
water vehicle. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And then for the
Love it.
London team, going with a more urban environment, a more kind of like centralized, this would be the team with the kind of the big three kind of commando specialists, which would be Stalker, Snake Eyes, and Scarlet. They would be the three kind of like leading this team, because I figure like Stalker, prior to joining the army, he was like leader of a street gang in Detroit or something like that. So he has some of this environment. Snake Eyes and Scarlet being like more of their like tactical stealth operatives and ninjas and commandos. They can work in this urban environment. I would also have Mutt and Junkyard in there in case they need some support. Also, just because I love Mutt and Junkyard. Always love the dog handler guy. And then just to round out this team for no particular reason, Rock and Roll. Just because the Beatles and Rolling Stones, and it's London, and
Very
it's like a
good. Very good. Yeah.
bring it. He's a heavy machine gunner if they need some firepower, and he'll also like he brings that to the table.
I was always a big fan of rock and roll. I always liked
He's
that character.
great,
Yeah.
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 And the
Great.
villains for this one would be Baroness, because I love the Baroness. She works really in any occasion. And Storm Shadow, back when Storm Shadow was a villain before he became
Gotcha.
a sort of ancillary G.I. Joe, so we could have some Snake Eyes versus Storm
Gotcha.
Shadow ninja battles.
Gotcha. You almost that team is almost the exact team that was in the very first issue of the Hot Potato storyline. You had Stalker, Snake Eyes, Rock and Roll, Scarlet. The only difference is instead of was Mutt and Junkyard weren't around yet, you had Hawk.
Yeah,
Otherwise,
that's
that's the
right.
exact
Yeah,
same
yeah.
team. Yeah.
Oh, I
Yeah.
wasn't thinking about it.
Very
Yeah, you're
good.
right. Yeah.
Very good. Yeah, well, I love those teams. I think that's fantastic. I had them sort of in my head too, as I was making the questions. The only changes I had to put Lady J in the Caribbean because I wanted her in something a little more revealing. And I did have Snowjob. I had Alpine. There's Iceberg. Isn't there another? There's another snow guy too, right? Wasn't
There
there a
was
guy
like almost
later,
every year there was
Frostbite or
Blizzard.
something like that, or Blizzard? Guy who had,
The second
yeah.
version of Stalker was actually a polar themed, like he was a tundra ranger and he had on like a
Oh, is
white
there? Okay.
jacket, but yeah.
Yeah. I had Alpine. I added who was it that I added to it? Oh, I had Stalker actually
Yep.
in the Arctic with them to sort of run that team. And then
Yep.
Duke running London. And then
Okay.
I had Flint and Lady J in the Caribbean to run that thing.
Nice,
And
makes
I
sense.
didn't flesh them out completely, but of course you're gonna have Torpedo in the Caribbean. And I thought about I had Shipwreck too. I always liked Shipwreck, so I had to put him in the Caribbean.
Yeah, he was one I had to cut, but yeah, he would have made sense there, yeah.
Very good. Very good. I love those teams. That would be I would watch that or I would read that. Absolutely. Now, fantastic question number two. What was your I sort of asked this already as we were talking, but what was your first G.I. Joe action figure and first vehicle? And name your five favorite Joe figures and Cobra figures that you own. So you can tell me five Joes and five Cobras
All right.
if you
So the
want to, if you
first
want to.
action, yeah, I think the first one that I got that I wasn't just playing with my brothers, but that was bought for me, I think was Barbecue, who was the firefighter who didn't look like a firefighter. He was in like this reddish orange wetsuit with like a black and gray helmet. He had like a handheld axe and a spray gun that shot water or foam, kind of nebulous.
I always
And
thought
all I
his
remember is,
helmet, I'm sorry, I always thought his helmet looked like the one that Princess Leia wore when she infiltrated
Oh
Jabba
yeah. He looked like a he looked like a Star Wars character.
house. Sorry, I'm sorry, go
No. I just remember opening him in the back of the car
ahead.
and his little tiny like water gun thing, it connected to a hose, but the gun part fell into like the seat belt thing, and I lost it seconds after opening it. And yeah, my parents were not thrilled. They were like, maybe he's too young for these toys. But he was my first toy. I think the first vehicles that I got, I think was the next Christmas, I got both the G.I. Joe Havoc and the Cobra Stun. So I had things to play off of each other.
What I don't know what those what were
The
those?
Havoc was it was kind of like the big vehicle of that second era. It's a preposterous looking vehicle. None of it makes any damn sense. It's sort of like a truck, but it's got two sets of treads, one in front of the other. The cockpit has the Joes like laying down on their
Oh,
stomachs to
yes, I know
drive.
what you're talking about. That's
The
ridiculous. It's
operator
a ridiculous
sits,
looking
yeah,
thing.
he sits on the roof with these two cannons, but he's fully
Yeah,
exposed,
he's
no
completely
protection.
exposed. It's the who's the it's like a country
Cross
boy type
Country
guy.
is
Cross
the,
country,
yeah,
country.
who, Cross Country, who has the Confederate symbol battle flag on his belt, which is the reason that figure hasn't been made recently. And then the Cobra Stun was a weird vehicle. It was like black and red, and it had like two like seats up front with cannons, but they could like split of the way. And it was on three wheels, so it kind of had a tricycle shape, but it had like it was yeah. At that point, they weren't basing these on actual human military vehicles. They were like, all right, we're going really science fiction-y. So as written, the question was my five favorite Joes and figures I own. So I'm approaching this as the figures that I loved as a kid, not necessarily the top five list I would make today.
Gotcha. I just
But
looked up the Cobra Stun, by the way.
okay,
I
yeah.
remember that. Yes. Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
So my top five favorite Joes I remember loving as a kid were the aforementioned Rakondo, and he was one that I loved off the bat, and then every year I would have a new favorite, like flavor of the month, Joe du jour, that a new one came out, and then I would go back and like Rakondo. Because Rakondo had the hat, he
Yeah, he
reminded me
had
of
the hat
Indiana
with the one
Jones.
brim was like
Yep.
was up. Yeah, I never understood why that was. Is there a reason for that? Do we know why?
No,
No,
something, yeah.
just
It was just,
sort
yeah.
of was up. Okay.
Ripcord, just because
Ripcord.
he was cool. He was all camouflage. He had the parachute pack and everything like that. I thought he looked cool. Sci-Fi, he
Oh
was like just covered in like neon green. He was like one of my first Joes that I got. His face, he looked like RoboCop, except he was neon green. He was a laser fire, so he was very futuristic. This was like, we're really going away from the traditional military aspect,
He was
but
sort of the updated Flash.
he was the new Flash. Yeah, basically all of the characters in 1986 were like updates of the
Yeah,
original ones,
Rakondo
basically.
was Stalker, basically, wasn't
Yeah, there was like a new Marine, there was a new Navy SEAL, there was a new medic, and all these
Oh
guys.
yeah,
Yeah,
Leatherneck was the Marine. That's
right.
right. Okay. Yep, sorry, I'm getting off track then.
Quick Kick, despite how ridiculous he seems, he was always one of my favorites. And for those who don't know, he is shirtless and shoeseless. He just has like black yoga pants and this red sash with throwing stars. He should not be allowed into a store or restaurant because he's not dressed appropriate. But he's like their martial arts, like silent weapon specialist, and he's a kung fu fighter. But I never found that ridiculous. Everybody kind of like grows up and like, okay, this guy is stupid. You can't use him in the battlefield. He's not, you can't use him in a jungle or against. It's like, I don't care. I always loved him. I
No,
never,
he was great. Although, looking back, you're like, was it a good idea not to wear a shirt and then have a bunch of throwing stars like across your
Hope he doesn't
chest?
have
Like,
nipple
don't
chafe
bend
on that.
over or anything like that. Sorry, go ahead.
And then my fifth one, this guy was from 1988, was Shockwave, who was like the SWAT trooper. And he was
Okay.
just in like, he had light blue and dark blue, and he had a ski mask and a hat over it. So he was kind of mysterious in
Oh.
like that, the same vein as Snake Eyes and Beachhead, where you couldn't really see
Yeah,
his face. And
yes.
that was cool. But he was also a different color scheme.
Right.
So I just thought he was kind of interesting at the time. I liked him.
Very good.
Favorite Cobras, and this The top three have never wavered. These were my favorite three as a kid and my favorite three today. Copperhead, who we mentioned, is the pilot of
Okay.
the Water Moccasin. Wild Weasel, the pilot of the Rattler, and Baroness. She's my
Gotcha.
third favorite. And then after that, as a kid, I liked a character named Heat Viper, who was one of the many just troop builder things.
Okay.
Heat Viper had a bright orange suit with purple trim and a bizarrely asymmetrical mask. Like, it didn't make sense. And he had this giant rocket launcher that he held upside down that a lot of people thought was a flamethrower because his name was Heat Viper, except Heat was an acronym for High Explosive Anti-Tank, so it was supposed to be a missile launcher. But he was one, like, you look at him, you're like, that's a Star Wars bounty hunter. Like, that guy should be standing next to Boba Fett and Dengar. That's not a G.I. Joe. So, and then the last one is Tela Viper. For some reason, he's the Cobra communications guy. And he's got short sleeves. I don't think any other Cobra had short sleeves. And he's blue and purple, which is the same color scheme as Hawkeye, the Marvel Avenger, who I always liked. So something about that color combo.
I always liked the basically the Cobra the Cobra Frogman, the
Oh,
like
the
their
eels,
version
the
of
Cobra
the
eels.
eels. Eels. I always thought that was a
Those were cool looking.
they were cool looking. And I like your Joes a lot. I had to. Oh, the other Cobra guy. I just always liked Zartan because it was like one of the original
Oh,
toys
yeah.
I had. And like I said,
Now,
for a while he actually did change colors. What in the sun for lasted
if I
for a
was
little while.
making that list today, Zartan would be in my top five.
Yeah.
And my top five Joes would include Spirit and Torpedo and Mutt and Junkyard and like other characters.
Sure.
Like, I shifted some of those, but those were the figures I remember loving as a kid and always wanting to play with.
And Snow Job was the other one I always
He's
loved. He
one of their,
was like one of the ones I got, and I remember just with the skis and everything. It was just so cool. It was so cool. All right. Well, here we go. Mystery fantastic question. You ready? A young Ryan Daly signs up for the Joe team. What would your skills be? What would your outfit be? And what would your code name be?
Okay, so
And don't
I
tell
don't
me
know
you've
how.
never thought of this.
No, I certainly have. I certainly have. And because this is sort of fantasy wish fulfillment, I can make this character an exaggerated version of myself. So I came up with a character. I came up with like 10 Joes when I was a kid, like, or maybe more than that, like original characters that I would have loved to see. And one of them was a dog handler, like a kind of a replacement for Mutt and Junkyard or Law and Order or something like that. And their names were Ruff and Tumble.
Oh, that's actually pretty
But
good. Ruff was
as
like
a
Ruff.
Ruff, but as the play, as the sort of joke, that's the Joe's name. That's the human's name. His name is Ruff, and Tumble is the name of the dog. And being able to kind of work that retroactively, I kind of I like I created this idea like in 1995 or something, but post, well, actually, like much later, 2011, I don't remember when it was. I kind of modified it after the Navy SEAL team that killed Osama bin Laden. I read a story about that, how that team, that DevGru team, included a dog with them and their unit, a Belgian Malinois called Cairo. So I kind of had this idea that it would see this figure, Ruff and Tumble, would sort of be like that, like the military working dog unit with him, would be either a shepherd or a Malinois like that. He would have kind of like generic kind of like desert tan pants fatigues or something like that. But then instead, like a whole thing, like just kind of like a solid color t-shirt, like a gray or a white t-shirt, but then a tactical vest over top of that. And then like a ball cap or something and shades or something like that, over top of it, something like that. And kind of generic, looking a little bit more special forces than like kind of typical military type of guy, but still like not super colorful, still kind of existing within the world of realism and stuff like that.
Okay. All right. Very good. So, Now, are you're going to stay with Rough and Tumble as that those are the code names?
That would be, yeah. I
Rough and
yeah.
Tumble. I like that. I like that. I think that's great.
If I could
So you got
resurrect
the
any of my
outfit
dogs, yeah.
and just again your overall skill, your dog handler. Again, I assume you're going to be familiar with all NATO and
All
Warsaw
NATO
Pact
and
small
Warsaw
arms.
Pact small arms, yeah.
Okay, very good. Very good. Any languages you know? Would there be any languages?
Sure, why not? Like, yeah, fluent in French, Arabic, Farsi, and yeah, something else,
All
I
right. Well,
will say.
you're going to hot destinations then, probably mostly. They're going to keep you in
Probably,
like
yeah.
Africa and in that
Maybe
area,
that's just more
Middle East.
contemporary based. I'm thinking more post, you know, 21st century than
Gotcha.
when this when the G.I. Joe was actually in its heyday.
Well, they were all over the place, so they go there too. That's great.
True.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, I like that. I like that rough and tumble. Very good. All right. Well, Ryan, that's it. It's closing time. So I can't thank you enough. This was so much fun. I know, especially this was on short notice, and I really appreciate you stepping up. I really appreciate it. So, where can everybody find you? Where can listeners find you?
Well, they can find me elsewhere on this Fire and Water podcast network. My main primary show is Cheers Cast, where I cover my favorite TV show of all time, which is Cheers, beloved sitcom. I am at the time of this recording, I am starting to record season 9, which my coverage of that should begin in September. But Chris Franklin and I have also started recording episodes of Batman Nightcast again. That should come out monthly. And with Paul Keen and Max Romero also on the network, we've started doing The Sandman Slept Here, which is part of the Justice Society Presents feed every couple of months, where we talk about the comic Sandman Mystery Theater. Also, from time to time, my brother and I do a music show at Fire and Water Records, and I will probably come back to Star Wars at some point with Give Me Those Star Wars now that Shag has his own Star Wars show
Right.
on the network. I'm feeling weirdly competitive,
You want to
and
show them up?
I'm feeling like
Yeah.
I can't abide that. So I gotta bring out some new Star Wars content. But yeah, I'm all over that place. Yeah.
Has sort of been a reawakening for you. You're kind of, yeah, I won't say I mean, you're always doing Cheerscast, so it's not like you were laying dormant, but all of a sudden there's this I feel like there's this spring of creativity since, and
I
I'd
was
like to
very
do
close, yeah.
I was just going to say, I'd like to credit myself because I feel like this all started when I joined the network that all of a sudden
Pretty
you were like,
much. Pretty much. I was close to just not podcasting again. I was close to just being done with it and just saying, I love you guys at the network, but I think I'm cashed out. And then various things in my personal life kind of changed momentum, things in like just kind of fandom reawakened certain things. But yeah, mostly it was you and Sean Ross coming to
Good.
the network. That
That's
was the spark that
What I
lit the new
wanted to hear.
fire in me. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. That's what I wanted to hear. All right, very good. All right. Well, again, and I highly recommend all those shows. I listen to them all. I have the two most recent ones you did with your brother. I have queued up. I haven't had a chance to listen to them yet, but I can't wait.
And we got to
And
do another one soon because we got to get our we're going through the different seasons of the year, and we need our fall
you
special
need
to
your
come out
fall one. Yeah,
next
well,
month. Yeah.
don't do it yet. I still have to listen to the summer one.
You got about 4 weeks.
All right, very good. Very good. Okay. Well, thanks again, Ryan. This was so much fun. I loved it. We'll have to again. We'll have to get together and talk the cartoon at some point and
Hang
four
on. In
thousand things I forgot about. Yeah.
case Rob Kelly is still listening, we have to talk about the Eagles. Like, where does Jalen Hurts rank in the top quarterbacks of the season? Like,
Oh, okay.
it
Yeah,
feels like he's being
absolutely.
disrespected by not being talked as top tier. But, yeah.
My mystery fantastic question was going to be, I was going to like, give me a few minutes on the Bears. I was going to ask you like how, what do you think of the Bears? But you know what? Now you brought it up and Martin Gray's head is about to explode. What do you, how do you feel about the Bears this year? How do you think they're going to do?
So I am very excited, but I want the fandom to understand that there's a lot of reason to expect them to be good. Don't expect immediate results. They have a very exciting new head coach, but he's a first-time head coach. There will be a learning curve. Caleb Williams, I think, showed a lot of flashes of potential greatness last year. He also showed a lot of ugliness, and I think part of that was the wretchedness of the offensive coordinator and head coach and the system that he was given. but I think he's not just I think he has to start. How do I want to say this? I think Ben Johnson, the new head coach, he has to unlearn a lot of things that he picked up last year, a lot of habits from his rookie year. I think it's not just picking up a new offensive scheme and new plays. I think he has to kind of revert to factory settings and like go back to the defaults and then start learning,
I
because there were just
100%
a
agree
lot
with
of bad habits that he picked up last year just
you.
because he was left adrift. And it's like, okay, we gotta break this all down, start from scratch and build it back up. Once that happens, I think they'll click. They fix their offensive line, I think. I think their defense is still pretty strong. I like their weapons. They're just in a really competitive division, so I'm not expecting it to be a gangbuster season, but I think as long as we see we're on the right track, we have the parts, this is we have the means to go forward and build something off of this. I want to have cautious optimism.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good. I kind of foresee them either having a hot start or a hot finish, one of the two. I think they're going to be in the mix for the playoffs. Again, it's going to be hard with Green Bay, with Minnesota, with Detroit. I mean, again, yeah, like you said, it's going to be really hard to make the playoffs in that division. Even if they could literally send three teams from that
They
division to
could.
the
They
playoffs.
absolutely could.
And I agree the cautious optimism. I think they're building something. I think I do think they're kind of taking Caleb Williams and grinding him down to I'm not grinding him down. That's not the right word to use, but sort of resetting him, stripping it down to the simplicities. Okay, make sure you can get out of the huddle in time. Make sure you can hold the snap. Make sure you can drop back correctly. Make sure you can read a defense. Things like that, and then move forward, like you said. So I think this is going to be sort of a learning year, a learning curve year for him. But if he is who he's supposed to be in a year or two, I think he's going to be a very good quarterback.
I
So
hope so. I hope so. And don't cut any of this out. This is precious content that the listeners need to
Are you
hear.
kidding me? I never cut any NFL content out, and of course, go Birds. So
There
that's a
you go.
winner as well. Okay, so once more, thank you, Ryan, for coming on the show. This was a lot of fun. We'll talk some more G.I. Joe at some point again, I promise you. So,
Absolutely.
yeah, and we'll be right back.
Afternoon, everybody.
Ryan!
How's that baby treating you, Mr. Daly?
Like Thanos snapping his fingers at my bank account.
In that case, how about a beer on the house?
Sure, gotta give my mouth something to do between podcasts.
Say, Ryan, I don't get how you have so much time for podcasting. Doesn't your wife want you spending time with the baby?
Would you? Truth is, I think she's a little worried about how much time I'm spending with the kid, ever since his first words were Dagobah system. Now she wants me to go out and do something mature, something productive, and most of all, something lucrative that can support the family.
So you're going to...
Podcast about Cheers, yeah. That kid's not going to start college for 18 years. I got time. Cheerscast, the podcast where everybody knows your name. Coming soon to the Fire and Water Network.
Okay, we're back. A quick note before we start the feedback. If you do not partake in alcohol, you're always welcome in the Fantasta Lounge. In the gallery page, I always include the recipe for the mocktail version of whatever drink we're making, if one is possible. So please, all are welcome in the Fantasta Lounge. Now, here's the feedback from episode 8 with future podcast conqueror Stella, featuring Batgirl and a sparkling fuzzy navel. This episode's guest, FW All-Star Ryan Daly, says, between winning the MVP and marrying Haley Steinfeld, I'd say Josh Allen has had a pretty good 2025 so far. Will he ever win the Super Bowl, though? Sadly, no, because the next 7 championships will go to the Chicago Bears. And after that, Josh will be past his prime. Oh, keep dreaming, Ryan. Ryan goes on, Great discussion with Stella. Batgirl Year One is a terrific miniseries and incidentally one of the comics that made me love Black Canary. Marcos Martin's art is stellar, and you can always see why he was such a great fit for Spider-Man several years later. His characters look like a fine hybrid of Ditko and Romita. That's actually a good comparison. And he follows up with, if I could add another villain to Batgirl's rogues gallery, it would be that famous X-Men villain, Dr. Octopus. Oh, Ryan. All right, over at the high top tables, Nate the Great says, I'd like to see Batgirl fight Captain Boomerang and Golden Glider. She's the female villain everybody forgets about, possibly because she's always fighting the Flash, not Batman. And you know, blonde bad girl. If it makes Stella feel better, Firestorm had to save Superman's butt from Killer Frost in DC Comics Presents number 17. Fantastic Lounge regular Martin Gray says, excellent show. It's always great to have Stella on board, even if it did bring out another big wedge of local sports talk. Why does that always happen when I'm on the rowing machine at the gym and can't fast forward 15 minutes? Come on, Martin. We're going to bring you in. We're going to bring you into the sports world. He continues, peaches are the fruit of Satan. They're disgustingly furry and make people slurp constantly. I agree they are disgusting to eat, but I don't know. I kind of like peaches, Martin. And Martin goes on, I hated the Killing Joke too, even when it was just an Elseworld. But how brilliant that John Ostrander and Kim Yale brought Barbara back as Oracle. The character DC had to write off became better and more popular than ever. DC did try to make another Oracle stick after the New 52, either in Batgirl or Birds of Prey, male, if memory serves. Awful idea. There's only one Oracle, and that's Barbara Gordon. Stella, it was explained in the Bronze Age that the minimum age for Congress is younger in the DCU due to the Knights Descendants Act or something. I think it had something to do with a Phantom Lady's dad. I believe that information came out of a letter column, so perhaps you've not been lucky enough to come across this marvelous bit of retroactive nonsense. Brett Velvet Tiger is the character fine slash rug of any year. Hiathus from Hawkman and JLA might be interesting as a Batgirl enemy because she is super cunning and has a great hat. Purple Fridays at Stella's workplace sound as oppressive as it does obnoxious. Keep rocking the red. Thank you, Martin. Fantastic Lounge Gold Card member Dr. Ann says, great show and discussion. Always love to hear Stella. A few comments. Fuzzy Navel. Interesting history. Didn't realize it was such a modern, quote unquote, modern drink. I vividly remember in college a buddy's girlfriend making herself a fuzzy navel and then filling a big tumbler of about 90% of the way with schnapps and a splash of OJ for color. Obviously, she was three sheets to the wind and most of that drink ended up coming back out and onto the sidewalk. Since visualizing that, I've shied away from that drink. A shame, really, because peaches are a favorite fruit of mine. Sounds like you're going to have some beef with Martin Gray after that comment. Batgirl Year One, such a wonderful series. I absolutely loved it. The art is so great, somehow being economical with line work, but still saying everything it needed to. Just perfect, favorite of mine. Can I echo that Brian Q. Miller's Steph Brown Batgirl series is 100% phenomenal. Secret questions. You know, this is not secret questions, guys. You know, you can go talk to Sean for that. This is fantastic questions to answer, but I'll let it slide this time. I do think Stella was thinking of Livewire. After all, Livewire was one of the villains in the DCAU Girls' Night Out, which teamed up Ivy and Livewire to fight Supergirl and Batgirl. For myself, I think the Prankster would have been a great villain for Babs. Babs, the quiet librarian, and such an orderly personality being thwarted by a chaotic jokester would be a great story. As a Patriots fan, I cannot root for the Bills to win a Super Bowl, but even I would root for them over the freaking Chiefs. I can't stand that team. I was thrilled that the Eagles trounced them in the Super Bowl. So was I. But I think the Chiefs were missing their most important player, the crooked refs. Please continue to talk sports for the small percentage of fans who absolutely love it. Boy, you and Martin are going to have a lot of beef fans, but I'm with you 100% on that. Fantastic Lounge regular Edo Boznar says, haven't read Batgirl Year One, but really want to because I've heard good things about it and because I really like Martin's art. If you're interested in some more recent-ish things he's done, I suggest Private Eye from 2015 and Barrier from 2018, both written by Brian K. Vaughan, as well as Friday from 2021, written by Ed Brubaker. I think all were published by some form of Image, but originally they appeared as digital comics at the Panel Syndicate, panelsyndicate.com, where they are still available on a name-your-own-price basis. I enjoyed all three and highly recommend them, but I digress. I enjoyed the conversation despite the lack of prior knowledge of the series in question. Although I have to say there was about 10 minutes during the answer of the mystery question when, despite the fact that you were speaking English, I didn't understand a word of what was being said. Come on, guys. I promise everybody in the lounge, I keep the sports to a minimum, but I like to sprinkle it in here and there. It's not going to kill you. And you might learn something. You never know. As a good, Edo finishes up, as a good villains for Batgirl's Rogues Gallery, Cheetah is a pretty good suggestion. Another who came to mind almost immediately is Cheshire. If we're poaching villains from the Marvel Universe, I'd like to see her take on Bullseye and ultimately kick his ass. You're agreed. Thank you, Edo. Fantastic Lounge regular Super Captain says, great show, Brett and Stella. I haven't read Batgirl Year One, but I did like the Robin Year One mini that Beatty and Dixon did, so I'm sure that I will get around to it. My wife and I really enjoyed the Batgirl Burnside run a few years ago. Batgirls was fun, too, with Barbara serving as a mentor for Steph and Cassie. I don't mind Babs as Batgirl, but I like her even more as Oracle. Those Chuck Dixon and then Gail Simone Birds of Prey issues are some of my favorite DC comics of the 90s and early 2000s. I really like that run, too. Super Captain continues, villains that would match up well with Batgirl. When Stella asked if Marvel villains were on the table, my mind went to Mystique. Her kind of shape-shifting would fit Gotham better than Clayface's brand. And Stella, I feel kind of bad that my favorite teams, yes, those guys from Dallas, are responsible for two of those four Super Bowl losses. But you can take comfort that the Bills have won as many playoff games in the last 4 years as the Cowboys have won in the 21st century. Not to mention the Cowboys' last NFC championship game was during the first Bill Clinton administration. Okay, Super Captain, because I like you, I'm going to pretend I didn't read that last paragraph about who you're a fan of. I'm going to let that slide, Super Captain. Fantastic Lounge regular Bucky749 says, great episode. I wonder what would happen if they did a Batgirl story where her version of the ventriloquist goes on the hunt for the original Scarface. Here's a fantastic question. See, Bucky gets it. Fantastic question. See that, Doc? I read a story where Johnny played a big prank on Ben and he used three big posters, Herbie, Super Skrull, and Dr. Doom. Which poster would you like? Doom all the way. Doom is all, of course. Of course I'm taking Doom. Fantastilon's regular Sean Ross and host of Peacebound and Down's Wonder Woman podcast says, Brett and Stella, fantastic episode. Batgirl Year One is an all-time favorite mini for me, so it was fun to hear you discuss it. Marcos Martin is such a great artist. He's a mix of Ditko and Allred. That's a good combination, too. But he hasn't produced a ton of work. I wish you were more prolific, but that's just me being selfish. Also, I love the idea of Cheetah fighting Babs. That would be an awesome fight. Fantastilan's regular Paul Kien and host of DC Special Cast says, great episode as usual. Never had a fuzzy navel. Sounds interesting. Love the Batgirl Year One series. A great choice with a great guest. Martin is a great artist, and he did a great Spidey, too. Wait, a lot of greats in there. You should talk to Nate the Great, Paul. After reviewing the escapades of Killer Moth on the Batman Family Reunion over the past few years, it was fun to hear about a time when he was taken slightly more seriously. Thanks, Paul. You know, I just noticed I got nothing from FW Godfathers, Rob, or Shag this month. It's like when your parents don't show up for your Little League game. Well, at least the lounge didn't let me down, so thanks, guys. Thank you all who listen. Be sure to subscribe to The Fantastic Four, available at Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and Spotify. And, of course, leave a 5-star review. Fantastic Four is a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. You can find all episodes of The Fantastic Four and many other quality shows at fireandwaterpodcast.com. Please leave comments on the website. Let me know what you think of the show. I'll read all feedback at the end of every episode. Follow us on Facebook at FW Podcast Network, Blue Sky at FW Podcast. Use our hashtag online, hashtag FW Podcast. And I can be found on Instagram and Blue Sky at Imaginate Design. Finally, if you like what you heard, support the Fire and Water Podcast Network on Patreon at patreon.com/FW Podcast. There you can unlock various rewards, including being name checked on the show of your choice. If you choose the Fantastic Four, I will buy you your very own Hiss Tank, or at least find some fun way to mention you on your name on the show every episode. Thanks again to Ryan Daly for knowing half the battle. Of course, the other half of the battle is Ryan's brother, Neil, a talented recording artist. Neil is here in the lounge to play us out. See you next time. Take it away, Neil.
woke up as the sunlight pierced the room, but stayed in bed naked till way past noon. So call in sick for work, cause we ain't done yet, and make a memory time won't forget. Cause hand in hand, yours and mine, having the time of our lives, and the crush, two of us are so in love. No need to rush, the world can't wait for us. Summer sun, our works and barbecues, our bodies and cold brews. This is the party of the year, and it's going off tonight like bullets in the air. We drop the top down as the engines roar, up the coastline to some vacant shore. We toss our beach towels down up on the sand, and let the waves crash on our skin so tan. Cause hand in hand, yours and mine, having the time of our lives, and a crush, two of us are so in love. No need to rush, summer sun, fireworks and barbecues, hot bodies and cold brews. This is the party of the year, and it's going off tonight like bullets in the so bright. I'll pull you close and hold you tight. Whatever's wrong, we can make right. Forever starts tonight. Cause we all know how the story goes. Two hearts become one under the summer sun. Fireworks and barbecues ignite to light this fuse. An inspiration muse with nothing left to lose. Summer sun.